Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-Centered Encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
So I just wanted to know, who would you say, in your opinion, is more confused about racism, white supremacy, black people or white people? Thank you. And thank you for being on the program this evening, sir.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you to all the callers. Thank you to Gus. And I'll go back in time and I'll answer a little bit about, you know, the way confusion and deception works in a racist system. This is from the Confessions of Nat Turner, when he's talking about his childhood that eventually led to him leading a slave revolt. Despite everything being stacked against him, learned to read. And he says, the black people around me were more surprised than the white people that I had learned to read. And I just thought that is a really powerful insight of the kind of confusion that can take place under oppression and lack of access to learning. That statement reveals a kind of bad faith on the part of the white people. In other words, when he says the black people were more surprised that I could learn to read than the white people were, right? That means that the white people had been telling the lie that black people were not capable of learning. But it means that the white people, because they were originators of that lie, in that culture, they knew it was a lie. But the black people, that is all that they had been told. So when Nat Turner is able to read, it surprises the people around him more than it surprises the white people. They knew that they were lying. So I don't know if that applies to all areas of confusion. I think there are probably a lot of things about white supremacy that white people are confused about and that I'm confused about. I can't claim to, there are aspects of it that baffle me, but I think I really do think of that Nat Turner moment as exemplifying how the people in power who control the lies are less confused about it than the people who have been forced to, who have never known anything other than the lie. And I think that might go with what you're saying about what happens to black people as victims of racism, even being led to participate in it.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, September 11th, 2017. So I have been told. Before we get started, we said it on the weekend broadcast, the compensatory call-in this past Saturday. But just again to emphasize, because we have lots of cows listeners in the Florida area, lots of cows listeners in the Texas area. I hope folks are safe. I hope you were able to evacuate if that was necessary to get someplace. You, family, loved ones, friends were able to get someplace. If you hunkered down, I know some of the folks that our Florida listeners, they called in over the weekend and, you know, said that they were staying put. So I hope if you stayed put, you were able to remain safe. You and anyone else that your shelter or wherever you were at was able to withstand any of the damage that came with the rains, hurricanes, all of that. And check in. Let us know. I know a lot of listeners were very concerned about folks who dial in on a regular basis to participate from those two areas. And even people that don't dial in to participate, I can tell you for almost 9 years of broadcasting, Florida and Texas for years, almost a decade, have been two states that have supplied us with lots and lots and lots of listeners. So, again, thoughts, prayers for folks in that area. All of that said, our content for today is not about the hurricanes, not even about what happened.
This session is no longer being recorded.
How odd. I don't know exactly what happened with that. Let's see.
The recording has started.
Okay. Got that taken care of. Strange. This broadcast is not about the hurricanes. It's not even about what took place on September 11, 2001, directly. Not about that either. We're talking about films, and I give my kind of preface anytime that we dedicate a program exclusively to talking about films, there should be a substantial burden of proof. I say that really anytime we broadcast, there should be constructive information. Black people, especially, there are massive problems confronting us, so we really do not have time to waste. If you're not getting constructive information from this broadcast, you should find something better to do with your time and energy, and specifically about these films. Anytime. That's why Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, you will hear her name invoked today. She used to tell us all the time, reading is more important than watching television. Absolutely. I'm going to try to say that as often as I can throughout the broadcast. That said, you can study films and learn a lot about
this
racism.
This session is no longer being recorded.
Fascinating. I am just going to leave that be. I've never had that be a problem before where, for whatever reason, the audio is not recording or keeps getting shut off. That's brand new, but I will not worry with that for the moment. As I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted for the second time, you can learn a lot studying films, and I hope the four films and burden would be all on Gus T today because I picked all of the films. Sometimes listeners have selected films. Sometimes we've looked at some of the films. Our guest for the program today, Dr. Kevorkian, his book, he has films that we've talked about from there, but I picked all of the films that we're talking about today. So if they are not constructive, if they're a waste of your time, if you watch them in preparation for today's broadcast, then that would be Gus T to blame if you did not pick up anything of value from these projects. Our guest, always a hoot to have him on the program. He's been with us many times over the past near decade that we have been doing the Cows. The first time he was with us in 2009, we discussed his book, Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America. A lot of very interesting information in the text, specifically deconstructing white supremacy in film, and specifically, I would say, kind of like sci-fi or films where there's some sort of robot or non-human entity, and talking about how a lot of times that non-human entity represents non-white people. You can look at a lot of different films. I think The Matrix, Terminator, lots of different films that that he talked about in the book and that we've discussed down through the years in his visits on the program. Really excited about hearing his commentary on the four films we're talking about today, of which I think he said he had only seen one. Joining us live, speaking of Texas, joining us live, professor at the University of Texas, Austin, joining us live once again, Dr. Martin Kevorkian. Dr. Kevorkian, you with us, sir?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Renegade, for welcoming me back to the show. I just want to echo what you said about thoughts and prayers going back out to the folks in elsewhere in Texas. We're very fortunate here in Austin and folks out in Florida as well. But thank you very much for that introduction, and I'm thank you for putting together these four films, and I always trust you to have the kind of questions that will elicit what I hope will be constructive insights.
I hope so. I think a few listeners have seen some of these films upon hearing that you were coming back, so hopefully they'll have some questions and insight as well. We'll certainly look forward to making time to hear their commentary also. I am so eager to get started with the films for the day. I'm almost ready to hop right in. I guess just for if we have any, I know we have newer listeners, this might be their first time hearing from you. The introduction, that was actually Dr. Martin Kevorkian. The intro clip, one of the very few times for years we've had many, many listeners ask our white guests who they think is more confused about racism, white people or non-white people. And almost every time without fail, even white people and non-white people have been asked that question. I would like 99% of the time they say immediately and with tremendous gusto, like, oh, of course, white people are more confused about racism. And then they give their explanations why. But Dr. Kevorkian, one of the very, and I mean, you can count on one hand number of people who have said, well, wait a minute, let's look at some illustrations of how non-white people have been more confused under the system of white supremacy. But anything you'd like to share with listeners? This might be their first time hearing from you, Dr. Kevorkian.
Well, I think maybe the most significant thing about my response is to think about the fact it's not something I figured out. I mean, it's something that I derived just from reading the confessions of Nat Turner in that case. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again, but you know, if you look at the book Color Monitors, anything I was able to figure out in that book started by reading Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, and we'll probably invoke Ralph Ellison's novel Invisible Man again today. So,
in Gus T's top five, we talked about that as well. Dr. Kevorkian visited with us, and we talked about Invisible Man as well, one of my favorite books all time as well, Ralph Ellison. With that, I think we will get started. Dr. Kevorkian will be sound clipped again. If you want to hear the full commentary, that audio segment at the beginning, that was when we were discussing the Purge films. Really important. Had some predictions about the presidential election in there. But he will be sound clipped again. We'll hear from one of his earlier visits later on. So for folks that are listening in, the four films that we are talking about today, The Place Beyond the Pines, released in 2013, The Big Lebowski, released in 1998, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, 2017 release, and Little Boxes, released in 2016. Everything, all of four of these films grew from Little Boxes. That was the film that I saw, which actually was recommended by a listener. He suggested two films. This was one. And wow. So everything grew from that film. It grew to Don't Feel at Home. We're kind of going in the reverse order that these films came to Gus. And hopefully as we go through, you'll see how they connected, or at least how they connected in my brain. So the film we are starting with, or actually even before I get to that, things that you should see that should be flagrant, blatant, the whole way through all four of the films that we discuss. Drug use, white drug use specifically, pretty flagrant all the way through, kind of a main theme in pushing the plot along in a lot of these stories. Racist jokes, I think, in a very unplanned way, there is a racist joke in every one of these movies, I think. One of them, sometimes they're a little more sophisticated, but at its core, pretty much they have a racist joke. Sometimes they have multiple racist jokes in these films. We'll make sure to pull those out. We have quite a bit of, I'll just make note. There's some other major themes, but those are two of the main themes that you should keep in mind and how they are playing out in these films, what they're even saying about white culture at this time. Starting off, The Place Beyond the Pines. I thought it would be great for this session, Dr. Kevorkian and I, if we take turns kind of giving a short synopsis of what we think the film is about. Since there are four films, we could each do two. And you have to take less than 3 minutes, 3 minutes or less, to give a synopsis of what the film is about for anyone who has not seen it. And then we can proceed with the dialogue. So I'll let you take the first one, which means I'll do Big Lebowski coming up next. You had 3 minutes or less to describe what
All right.
The Place Beyond the Pines is about.
Place Beyond the Pines. Man, I'm bad at retelling stories. I gotta tell you the truth there. But it's one that is has very unusual structure for a movie. It turns out to be multi-generational, and it's about starts out with. I mean, it's got a series of conflicts that play out particularly between a couple of families over those generations. But I mean, it's very unusual. Then it starts out, you sort of think Ryan Gosling is going to be the central character. He's kind of a bleached blonde outsider. Partway into the film gets shot and just occupies the screen for just a fraction of a second with Bradley Cooper, who then becomes kind of the main character from there. But then finally, it comes down to a conflict then between the sons of these two men. And they are kind of the final main characters of the story. So I wouldn't say it's got a clean three-part structure in that way, but it's Ryan Gosling and his romance with Eva Mendes at the beginning, and being in rivalry with a black man for her affections and loyalty in that part. Subsequently, then it's about Bradley Cooper and his dealing with the fallout of having shot the Ryan Gosling character and concealing that fact from his son. And then the two sons gradually finding out the secret of their violent past and having to work that out. That's not a very good summary. Place Beyond the Pines.
I thought that served pretty well in terms of summing up a complicated movie. I was kind of glad to pass on that one because that is a difficult film to explain. As you said, it's not the usual straight line forward type of film that you would see. It's got some time jumps and all of that as intergenerational conflict. It's a bit unusual. I guess the thing that I picked out first when you started, in my view, Ryan Gosling, Luke is his character's name. I think he's the central character even after he dies. Like, I think he only occupies about the first 50. This is kind of it's over 2 hours, a longer film. He occupies physically the first 50 minutes of the film. I think he dies right at around the hour point, maybe a little less. But even mm-hmm. from there forward, he continues to dominate the film, like all the way to the very end. I guess the one thing I would take issue with strongly in your synopsis, you described him as kind of a beach blonde outsider. Beach blonde, true, important, right? Let's keep that in mind. But man, that is like super minimizing. Like, this guy is a total terrorist. Like, is it what? Let me stop right there. Is that accurate to say he's a terrorist? Is that accurate?
That is accurate to say.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. To give listeners the detail, if you have not seen this film, like the full rundown, like this guy starts out, he's literally a freak. He's in some sort of like carnival, it looks like, where he's doing motorcycle stunts, riding around in a big ball dome of some sort. And he's come back in the town where his love interest with Eva Mendez's character, where he bumps into her again, and it kind of goes from there. But this guy has some sort of criminal history before. We find that out. We don't know what that is, but that's not hard to believe once you see his conduct. He is robbing banks where their MO is not just to rob banks. Their MO is to go and find the oldest elderly woman teller that you can and make her do all of the dirty work in the robbery. It's not just robbing banks. It's robbing old women at banks. He is given the option when they start this, we're going to go out and rob banks. He's given the option. His white partner says, you don't have to use a gun. I've done this before. I never used a gun. Our beach blonde outsider says, oh, no, I want the gun. We're going to go get the old elderly women tellers to do our bank heist. So he's robbing banks, armed robberies repeatedly. He assaults a black male who's been taking care of his child while he's been gone. He fathers a child with Eva Mendez's character, He doesn't find out about this until a year later. In the meantime, she's been staying with a black male. He's been supporting her. She's in his house and, you know, the whole nine. She has a pretty low level job. He assaults him, gets arrested. That's a felony assault. He gets a very low bail. He sticks a gun in the mouth of his best friend at gunpoint and demands the bail money back after he's been arrested. We could take up a whole lot of time just tracking all of his criminal activity. In the 50 minutes he's on the screen, he participated in so much terroristic behavior. There was no way that I could get into, oh, I feel bad that this guy is gone. In my view, they need you to be emotionally invested in this character. In my view, if you don't emotionally invest in Luke, Ryan Gosling, you're not probably going to be feeling this movie too much if you don't have some sort of emotional connection to him. What do you think about that, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I think it's super important not to minimize the violence and criminality of his behavior, as I tended to do when calling him an outsider, because I just want to say, yeah, drug use is running through all these, racist jokes is running through these. But another thing that I found ran through just about all of these is white males getting away with criminal activity with minimal consequences. Somewhat to a lesser degree here, to the extent that he actually does go to jail, but you see sort of bad behavior, irresponsible behavior, criminal behavior, violent behavior going by without consequence for characters in, I think, each of these films. So I think it's really important not to minimize that. And it's also then important what you said, that it's strange, given that he is such what should be such an unsympathetic character, that in fact the movie is set up to where his presence looms even after he's gone. You know, he should be the kind of character, it would be kind of like, it would be a relief for that kind of person to be out of everyone's life. And yet there, it almost is a kind of, there's almost a kind of sentimental nostalgia for him. There's just very weird, illogical sequences. There's, sometimes it seems like the Eva Mendes character is behaving in a way that you might expect, like basically, you know, take your trouble and hit the road and stay away from me. But then there's moments where, sort of inexplicably, right after the screen has just showed us episodes of his bad behavior, then he suddenly gets back together with her. I don't know if that's a sequence that struck you or not, but it seemed to me that there was a kind of, and it struck me as one of the moments where I wasn't with the film and didn't understand the decisions that were being made by the characters.
Some of that, I think, very important racial classifications. I have, so these are two questions. So Romina, who's played by Eva Mendes in this film, is Romina classified as white?
It's a good question. I was thinking that she was classified as non-white, but I thought, you know, Romina is almost like an Italian name, though. I think if you look at the way her family is cast and played, that, you know, her mother seems to be portrayed as being of Latina ethnicity. So I think it plays as she plays as reads as Latina. But
So is Eva Mendes, is she classified as white?
Oh, I'm not sure. I hadn't. I wouldn't. I would. I would. I would say the same thing about her. I mean, that would be my best guess, is that she tends to be an actress who is portraying, you know, Latina characters. I'm trying to think.
She's in Training Day. I think we talked about that before.
That's what I was just going to ask you. I'm trying to remember back to Training Day. There's a very similar dynamic to training day, and that in training day, she's with Denzel Washington, but is asked to basically betray Denzel Washington in favor of the white man. Is it Ethan Hawke in that one? Or
Correct.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But, yeah, it does seem like she's the fact that we even have this question suggests the way that she's being cast as someone that the white and the non-white character are fighting over, as if trying to claim one aspect or another of her identity. I'm not sure, but that possible ambiguity leads to her being cast in that kind of a conflict.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. Actually, Denzel Washington and Eva Mendes are paired together again in Out of Time, which I do not think we've talked about, but you don't need to see. But that is, they do pop up together a few times on the silver screen. Eva Mendes, I suspect that she could be accepted as white. For any fight fans who are excited about the Triple G and Canelo Alvarez fight that's coming up this weekend, I would say look at Canelo Alvarez now. That person, he speaks fluent, great Spanish, outstanding, probably could teach a class, born in Mexico. You look at him, man, he looks like, they say he's the Irish, most Irish looking Mexican person you could ever see. I'm real sure he would be classified as white, Canelo Alvarez. I think Eva Mendes, looking at a lot of her roles and what have you, I think a lot of times it's because of the language and what have you and names, that sort of thing. It might be coded as, this is someone that we're classifying as not white. In terms of her as a real person, Eva Mendes, I think she could be classified as white. In this film, Romina's character, I think there's a lot of coding both with her mom speaking Spanish and just a lot of the scenes. I think it seems like she's coded maybe as a non-white person, but I could be wrong. Folks would have to see the film and come to your own conclusions, particularly when you see the color of their offspring. Super, super pale offspring is not a Barack Obama at all. Super pale, I think Justin is named. He would be accepted, classified as white, the offspring that she has in the film with Luke, the outlaw bandit, bank robber. With even the talk about the fathers, because some of the reviews of this film, it was revolting enough that they said at its core that this movie is about dads, fathers' relationships with their sons. Luke's relationship with Justin, Luke is the robber again, and Bradley Cooper's character, who is the police officer who shoots and kills Luke, and his relationship with his son, AJ. And that's like the very end of the movie. Their relationship. They've said that this film is about fatherhood and fathers and fathers who are struggling with this job. That repulsed me even more because Luke is not a father. Like, nothing about his kind. He is a terrorist. That's the only label that he has in this movie. Yes, his character, they had sex. He had a child. But he's not been there at all. Like, he comes to drop off toys, and within 5 minutes of trespassing and coming to drop off toys, he's picking up a wrench and bashing in the skull of the black male who's there in front of his child, no less. Even stopping before that, the first time I watched this film, I was in a lot of back pain, so I couldn't sit up and watch it. So I missed some of the scenes because I was prone, where I was just listening. When I was able to go back and watch it again, seeing it, I missed the scene where, going to your point about how she makes bad decisions, where she has sex with Luke. They've met a few times. They've just talked. And then she meets him after he's robbed a bank, no less. That's what I thought was really important. I think it's after his first successful bank heist. They're in bed together and he gets to have sex with Romina. I was appalled. From this point forward, you've given him total license. Any of his behavior that he would like to participate in, if he wants to come in the house, anything. Because, hey, if we're having sex again, then I'm pretty much back in the picture. You were going to respond to that?
No, that you put your finger on. That is exactly the sequence that I didn't say precisely, but yes, it was right after the first heist. And then he gets together with her. And then he takes the kid out, for ice cream. It's like this warm family moment of celebration, mm-hmm. like dad pulled the bank job, and very strange.
Exactly. Yeah. And I want people to think about that. Dad pulls a bank heist. We go have sex and then go out for ice cream. Our son's first ice cream, and get to have this sentimental photo that will play out for the rest of the film, all the way to the very end. Could Luke's character, who's Ryan Gosling, again, beach blonde white guy, could you have this character with Luke being a black male?
Yeah, I think that's yeah, I mean, I thought of that a couple of times. I thought of that with the I didn't do that thought experiment for him, and I agreed no, absolutely not. But I did that thought experiment with actually a couple of characters, with the Walter Sobchak character in The Big Lebowski. You know, the guy, you know, pulling out a gun in a bowling alley and
doesn't go to jail.
Yeah, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah. No, I mean, and to that regard, I mean, it's whatever you say, you know, negatively about the film, it's representing something that is instructive about culture there, right? About precisely about that kind of a double standard. I mean, it's not even a strong enough word for it, but that kind of disparity of experiencing consequences for an illegal action, which we see in, you know, incarceration rates for the same crimes and the same behaviors in real life. So there's something that's kind of true to life in a very disturbing way about that.
Context of white supremacy, true to white supremacy culture. The character, I'm going to mispronounce his name. Please forgive. I'm a victim of racism. Marjorie Ali. He is the black male character who is, I don't even know what to call him, I guess, Eva Mendez's love interest, although you never see them like in an intimate moment. Like, you see her and Luke in bed together. You see them kiss. You see them hug. Like, you see lots of romantic moments. She's been with him for a long, long, like years. You never see, unless I missed it, Dr. Kevorkian can correct me, you never see them like together, out on a date, like nothing. It's just, you'll see them together, and it's generally him being attacked, the police coming to raid their house and take their belongings, them being together in a courtroom and hoping that their son doesn't get sent to jail for 15 years. Like, there's no romance between them. With his character specifically, I wanted to say, I think he gets the worst roles imaginable. Part of this is why I really do not enjoy films with a lot of black people. Mr. Ali's character, he was in Luke Cage, where he was killed. One of his own family members took a microphone platform and beat his face in. He was in Supremacy, which is another film that's all about white supremacy. Danny Glover's in it. It's based on a true life story where a pair of avowed white supremacists, they were released from prison. And the day they were released from prison, they shot and killed a police officer who was played by Mr. Ali. He's also in House of Cards. His character Remy is in a tragic arrangement with a white person. And even his name, Remy, I think that's an alcoholic beverage. And he's in the film that just got the Academy Award. I think it's Dream. Every single film that he's been in, his role has been absolutely atrocious. When you started the commentary from the audio clip when you were with us last time, and you were giving the commentary about how the system of white supremacy can incorporate and get black people to work with that system, look at every single role that Mr. Ali gets. Prime example. He's a victim. I'm not fussing at him. If anything, I would say get a new agent, because you get the worst possible roles. Did you have any commentary on his role in the film, even his relationship with the son, Justin?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I found, you know, that I wanted to highlight that comes back more than once, and you've already pointed to it, is sort of the freedom that Luke feels in just walking into this man's house. And, I mean, it seems like his role there is to be disrespected by the Luke character. He's just walked into this man's house, and he says to him, "What you looking at?" I mean, the man, the intruder says that to the man whose house he's walked into, right? And in the same scene, he says to Romina, "Don't talk down to me." I mean, here he's the intruder, but he's the one who's presuming to regulate the way the people in the House are supposed to behave towards him. In that sense, I mean, that's one reason why I saw, you know, in those, there's a kind of symmetry in the way he treats Kofi and the way he treats Romina, that he presumes a kind of power in both of those relationships. And then he comes back, he's talking to Kofi in his house. He says, you've got to lower your voice. I mean, he's not saying, like, let's be more quiet. He's issuing it then as if he can give him a command. And there was sort of that one moment where Kofi stands up to him and says, you know, excuse me. But then we have Luke escalating it on to the full-on violence and clocking him with the wrench. You know, at which point Romina finally says, you're crazy, and that it's over. But again, it seems like it's a kind of scene that would just take Luke out of the picture. And yet he continues to, as you say, to haunt, even sentimentally haunt this picture with it, you know, the film with the ice cream picture that keeps coming. Was it the other scene? I wanted to just mention it, but there's a kind of a playful scene with Kofi's character where he impersonates Darth Vader. You know, he's saying to the kid, look, I'm your real father. This is, he's talking to Luke's biological offspring, but the boy that he has raised. I mean, he was there for his baptism. We see him. I mean, one thing you can say is he is portrayed as a good father. It's just that the movie doesn't do him the respect of sort of giving him the payoff for that in any way. But he says, you know, look into your heart. You know it to be true. I am your father. He's kind of imitating the Darth Vader voice there and kind of making a joke of it. I guess Darth Vader speaking to a different there.
I remember that scene. The thing that that at least for me, that is most trashy about that scene is it's at the same tacky ice cream parlor that Luke and Eva Mendez visit after he's pulled a bank heist the first time and they go have sex. And then they go to this ice cream parlor. So then 2 hours later in the film, now Kofi is there with his son 15 years later and they're having ice cream and it just doesn't measure up the whole time. It's, man, I wish Luke was here. I wish old dad, the gangster, was here. So as you said, it pales in comparison. Luke's moment with ice cream to Kofi's moment with ice cream. No contest. We get a new agent, Mr. Ali. He was in Hidden Figures too, where he gets to deliver a few sexist lines to one of the main characters, if folks saw that. The scene, I did have a couple quick sound clips. I have many more sound clips from The Big Lebowski and Little Boxes because those two were much more sound clip friendly. But I do have sound clips from this film as well. I did want to ask... I did want to make at least one important point and get your comments. Towards the end of the film, like as he said, this it's kind of sectioned into three parts. So the third part is Luke Gangster, his child, and Bradley Cooper's child. Bradley Cooper is the officer who kills Luke the Gangster. So Bradley Cooper's child, AJ, and Justin, these two children, they're about the same age, 16, it seems, 16, 17, high school seniors, it seems. They meet, hook up, have conflict, blah, blah, blah. By the time it ends, Justin is ready to leave. This is Luke's child. He's ready to leave. He's done with all this. He's mad at his mom because she hasn't talked to him about his white gangster father. He's upset, feels like she's lied and, you know, hidden his dad from him. He goes to meet the guy who helped his father pull these bank heists. And so this older white guy, he looks like he's probably in his late 40s, 50s. He goes to meet this guy and this is the guy that his white dad put a gun in his mouth the day before he goes to get killed, put a gun in his mouth, takes his money back and leaves. He goes, and his son, Justin, is like, hey, can you tell me about my dad? I'm Luke's son. Can you tell me? And this guy's just like, oh, yeah, me and your dad, we were really close. And he's got newspaper clippings. This guy put a gun in your mouth. Like, and I said, this is how white supremacy works. Everybody that he goes to talk to sanitizes his dad or doesn't tell him the truth. Kofi doesn't say, yeah, your dad, in addition to robbing a bank, he busted my skull with a wrench in front of you in my own house. That doesn't get told to him. It's just, oh, yeah, he robbed a couple banks. He was a gangster, whatever. But we had ice cream that one time and took a photo. Like, it gets completely sanitized. And I feel like the same sort of thing happens in the system of white supremacy, where lots of white people get revered, worshipped, and we'll just cherry pick all of the nasty things that they did to practice racism and terrorize black people. We'll just sanitize all of that, and you can still empathize and feel good about thinking back on them and wishing they were here and having that connection. This happened. This is a staple, really, of white supremacy. That's why I said I think it's core for this movie that you do empathize with Luke, even though he is an elderly white woman robbing terrorist. Does that make sense in terms of how his terrorist legacy or criminal legacy is sanitized when it's passed down to his son?
I think that's precisely correct. I mean, the line that I remember is that friend, when the son shows up, he literally says the words, he was a good guy. It's not just sort of like vague warm up, but I mean, categorically, he says he's a good guy. You know, I mean, and that's what the movie's, in a sense, maybe trying to sell to you. I mean, that, oh, in the end, he was a good guy. I will say, though, that you know, one thing we also haven't talked about is the Ray Liotta character and, you know, his gang of cops operating outside of the law. And they have sort of this white brotherhood. They call one another bro, and they help one another get away with things. So they are also a version of that sanitization or ability of that sort of gang of white men to get away with what they're doing because they stick up for one another. And they say, oh, yeah, you can trust this guy. You can trust that guy. You know, he's one of us. He sort of thinks that Bradley Cooper is going to be, you know, playing for their team. But one of the stunning things that he says, sort of celebrating this violence and this really crass attitude toward human life, is he knows that the Bradley Cooper character has shot someone in the line of fire. And he kind of makes a joke where he says, you already got one in the bag, and he was white. That's an extra 50. And I think you take that a lot of ways, but I mean, you know, that thing about it being an extra 50, that sort of a white man is a higher value target. But I think in the sense of the odds of it, that it's such a low probability event that it would be, it sort of implies that it would be even more of a non-event had he shot a non-white victim. But,
I had a sound clip of that, but beat me to the punch. No, that is great. I don't have to play it now because you captured it. I was just going to get that short moment at the dinner table where exactly at the dinner table, no less. And in fact, you might even count that as a racist joke for people who remember Norm Stamper.
Yes.
He is the former chief of the Seattle Police Department. He carried a gun and a badge for 3 decades. He's been a guest on this program repeatedly. He, in his book, Breaking Rank, he, as an officer, said that is exactly what they would do when they got to go out and shoot someone. He said in his book, he wrote it, they would come back and celebrate like they scored a touchdown at a football game. If they got to shoot someone, he said in his book, he said that he himself would choke people out and whisper in their ears, he was choking them out, you're going to die, asshole, forgive the language. But that's what he said. I asked him about it twice on the program, and he confirmed. But all of that rung true to me, even when Bradley Cooper's character goes to turn these guys in, and the captain says, oh, no, what are you doing? Get out of here. We're not doing that. Who do you think you are, trying to turn on fellow officers, and scolds him and kicks him out of the office and then goes to tell the other officers, like, hey, he tried to snitch on you. All of that rung very true, very authentic as part of the white racist code, no snitching. Another piece that rung clear, and this is a very quick clip. I had to listen quick. This is 15 seconds. Bradley Cooper, he moves up the ranks. He turns on his other white officers to advance his own self-interest. Eventually, he's running for attorney general, becomes district attorney, and is moving right on up the ladder. In his campaign for state in New York to become attorney general, he's talking with his campaign advisors. 15-second conversation that they have. Listen closely.
You're going to go to a place where you're going to order something called a garbage plate. Just want you to be prepared for it. That's what you're going to do that.
Yeah, no, it's
and then Sunday morning, black churches.
Oh, perfect.
Right.
For those who couldn't hear because they had music in the background, the reason is because this is a low conversation that they're having. You're looking at his son. This is by the poolside. So you're looking at your son. This conversation is not really relevant to the plot of the film, but you can hear them talking about the campaign strategy. And they say after the garbage plate on Sunday, black churches. Perfect. And they go on with the scene. And he does win the election. Did you have a quick comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's just in the same way that the Ryan Gosling character is shown to be a criminal terrorist and is still thought of sentimentally. I mean, Bradley Cooper is consistently shown to be completely cynical. I mean, it starts to set up like you think he's the good guy and the whistleblower, but as you say, it's all about advancing his own interest. And this is just another one of those moments where he sort of, it's very cynical the way he says perfect, right? He knows he's going to play the angle. He knows he's going to be able to appeal to, you know, the good citizens and tell his story of being the lawful hero when he's not the upstanding citizen that he portrays himself to be.
Exactly. And I think, as well, going back to what we started with, white people being ignorant about racism, it seems like they are not ignorant about, oh, yes, white person going to a black church. I know that very well. I know how that script goes perfectly. Last clip from the film, talking about the third vignette with AJ, Justin. These are actually, I'll just stop right there. This is a scene where AJ and Justin, this is after they first met at the same high school. They go outside to do drugs, and this is the conversation that unfolds as they are doing drugs. I'll ask my question after we play the sound clip.
My wife's smoking cigarettes all the time.
You look smoking when you're smoking.
You smoke menthol, man? Like a breath of fresh air.
Like a breath of fresh air, but you don't care. You got the smoke puff blowing everywhere, I swear. Yo, here we go. I said my spit is my ammo, my mouth is my gun. I shoot up your whole squadron with one flip of my tongue and you done.
When'd you write that?
No, I'm not trying to lie. I wrote that.
Context of white supremacy. They do their drug session and then he wants to smoke cigarettes, menthol specifically, and then he does his rhyme. This is all AJ. Then he does his rhyme that he's written. AJ's character specifically, is he, quote unquote, acting black?
I mean, I took that to be a white character acting black, not a non-white character acting black. Distinction makes sense. I mean, we'll see, you know, in another one of these films where there's a non-white character who is, through peer pressure, expected to act black in a certain way, act more black. But this seemed to me the kind of more typical, like the suburban white kid who appropriates a kind of a hip-hop attitude as a way of trying to be more authentic or trying to be more cool. Trying to have that kind of kept to him by appropriation. I mean, he literally appropriates. I mean, he goes to the non-white character to get the drugs. He goes to the non-white character later to get a gun. So there's the way in which the movie portrays sort of the non-white side of town that he goes to as being the source of these things that he is getting, that he is trying to build himself up with. I feel like the way that he performs that rap is consistent with him being a white character putting on an act.
I would agree. And even that being what is considered, quote unquote, acting black, menthol cigarettes, drugs, rap, like even that is wow in terms of what is thought of. But yeah, I agree with that assessment completely. And as well as I thought it was important to they go to black people because they're not a whole lot of black people in the film in terms of main roles. But they do go to black people to get drugs. They do go to a black person to get an illegal gun down towards the end of the film. I thought that was important as well. Did we anything significant that we omitted, left out before we transition to the Big Lebowski?
No, it's just something I think that we'll come back to, but I think there's a kind of pattern here that shows up in some of the other films that the white characters are expressing and acting out a kind of resentment, as you might even call it, kind of a post-Obama backlash, maybe the post-Obama backlash that in part gave rise to Trumpism. There's a resentment, especially at black men holding places of authority and social standing. In this film, it's very much played out with the way Ryan Gosling acts around the Ryan Gosling Luke character acts around the Kofi Mahershala Ali character. You'll see other, in the other films, there are characters that sort of stand in for law and order, stand in for good citizenship, and you have white male characters expressing resentment and acting angrily towards those characters.
Absolutely. I think an important one for me, although this is going to come up huge when we get to our concluding film, Little Boxes, even the white children display that animosity towards black people in perceived positions of authority. AJ is not pleased about Kofi's presence either. He almost has a tiff with Jen. These are white teens. Again, white people are not ignorant about racism. Even young AJ looks at this as a problem. You've got that guy, that black guy in your house? Like, wow, not ignorant about racism, even as a young teen. But again, this will pop up again later with even younger white children who seem to have a very... Go ahead.
I'd say the line that I wrote down is AJ says, when did he move in?
Mm-hmm.
And it is actually his house. But there's the presumption that it's not his house. There's the presumption in his statement that the black man is always portrayed as the intruder in the house. Just as the Luke character, even though he's the intruder, treats Kofi like the intruder. AJ does the same thing in The Next Generation. It's a replication of that through time.
Exactly. And AJ is not Luke's son. AJ is the son of an upstanding police officer. Justin is the son of Luke. But just from one generation of racist to the next, in my opinion, white people are not allowed to be ignorant about racism. And again, cannot wait. That is going to come back up again later. Transitioning to the Big Lebowski. Oh, and I can track. Okay, so how the progression with these films. All of the rest of these films are directly related to each other, and I'll point out how I connected them as we go. That The Place Beyond the Pines is not. I saw that, or I saw three films. I saw these three. Someone asked me, have you seen any other films? And I said, no, not really. I don't really try to watch a lot of television. Reading is more important than watching television, so I went to look. I looked on Netflix, and The Place Beyond the Pines popped up as one of the tops on Netflix, even though it came out in 2013. Sometimes I guess they have reviews or when things get added to Netflix, but that was the film that popped up, and it was unusual enough that I thought we could discuss and add it in with the rest. All the rest of these films are connected, and I can show you how I connected them as we proceed. The Big Lebowski came out in 1998. The Coen brothers, Joel, Ethan Coen, they are Hollywood legends. Oh, I'm supposed to explain this one. Okay, let me not be on the clock for my film synopsis. This is just how this film came to be selected. This film is kind of goofy. It's older. This film came out nearly 20 years ago. I think a lot of people would just say this is a dumb movie that, you know, doesn't matter, or maybe it's a cult classic, as they say, but there's nothing substantial in terms of learning about racism, learning about white culture. I would say the Coen brothers, they are Hollywood royalty. Even if you don't recognize the names, I'm very sure if you've watched television over the last 25 years, you have probably seen quite a few of their films. They did Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, Fargo, The Big Lebowski, Burn After Reading, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Hail Caesar. I mean, they have a pretty substantial and critically acclaimed body of work. So I would say just that alone, and then the cast that's in this film, John Goodman, John Turturro, the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, who died from a drug overdose, Jeff Bridges, Steve Buscemi, the late David Huddleston, Sam Elliott, Julianne Moore, all-star. It's very rare that you're going to, most films, I don't think any of the other films that we're watching today have a cast comparable to this one in terms of Hollywood, big names in Hollywood. Very important film, and I would just pick out Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. That was what made me look at this film in a very different way. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, The Isis Papers, her chapter, Ball Games as Symbols, she writes, "The suggestion here is that all ball games in the white supremacy system culture similarly play out at an unconscious level, dominant political, i.e. power concerns. The fundamental power concern in the white supremacy system culture is white genetic survival through white supremacy domination. Such domination can be established and maintained only if white males and females, the total white collective, control all of the balls, testicles of non-white men, off and on the playing fields and ball courts. In other words, the name of the real game, the power game, is continuous worldwide control of the testicles of all non-white men by white males and females as the only means of ensuring white genetic survival in a world where the melanin-producing genetic material of non-whites is dominant. Without control of the non-white genetic material, whites will be annihilated genetically." I'm just turning one page because she goes through specific ball games and how you see her theory replicated in these different ball games. One of the first ball games she gets to related to the Big Lebowski, bowling is also an interesting ball game in the white supremacy culture. Usually, this game is played with a large black ball being rolled forcefully down an alley where it is expected to knock down 10 white pins. The central pin is referred to as the kingpin. Clearly, the bowling pins are white and, in shape, are phallic symbols. In other words, the pins are white phallic symbols that are knocked asunder by a heavy black ball over which the bowler attempts to gain mastery. In symbolic fantasy, the bowler sees himself as master and possessor of the larger black ball and thereby in control of the harm it can bring to the white male genital apparatus, the white penis. Bowling was introduced to America by Dutch colonists in the 18th century. It is a derivative of the French games Guiles that was brought to England in the 19th century and later to Germany. Games that consist of throwing balls of various size date back to ancient Rome and Greece. I will stop there. All of this, The Isis Papers, The Keys to the Colors, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, been a guest on our program many times over the years. I have still not given my synopsis, which I will, but just I wanted to at least explain what prompted me to look at this film in a very different way and say, oh, wow, this should be analyzed very closely to study racism, white culture. What I just read, does this sound applicable to The Big Lebowski?
Dr. Frisch, because honestly, that just blew my mind, actually. The description of, the specific imagery and the way that the bowling balls and the kingpin are showed together, they construct the very imagery that you're talking about in those dream sequences. Absolutely. I was wondering what the connection would be, and this is more than I could have imagined. So yes.
the late Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. Her absence, I wish, was saying, man, I would have loved to have gone to her house and watched this film, because I had not known her to be a fan of the Coen brothers. I've never heard her mention this film, but I would have loved to have sat down and checked this one out with her. I got to give my synopsis. Okay. Film comes out in 1998. However, the setting is 1990, I think, early 90s, right at the time of the Gulf War, first time around. President George H.W. Bush is president, and it's following two white males, Jeff Bridges' character, the Dude, and Walter, played by John Goodman. They love to bowl, so most of this movie is at a bowling alley or them trying to get back to the bowling alley, but it's a kind of goofy comedy. It is roughly the Dude. He's the main character. He's a pot-smoking hippie in California. There is another white person with his same legal name. Jeffrey Lebowski is his name. There's another white person with that name. He is married to this younger white person. She apparently has upset some other white people, so they come, they raid the Dude's house, and it just kind of goes from there, where he's upset because these people have wrongly come and invaded his house, urinated on his rug, and he wants compensation for his rug. And it just kind of goes from there. I could give you more of the plot, but the Coen brothers themselves said the plot is not really that relevant for this film, and it's kind of a goofy plot anyway, so just the short and tall of it, bowling alley. The Dude, Walter, they're going throughout this movie and bumping into all of these people, and it's just kind of watching them smoke weed, bowl. They have these goofy dream sequences. You just kind of get lost into all of the foolishness of all of this, these different adventures they have, and as they meet all of these different people. And this is all narrated by Sam Elliott, who even steps into the film time to time to chat it up with some of the characters. Does that suffice for a synopsis?
Yeah, I very much had in mind that idea when you said you got to summarize this, that exactly the Coen said, that it's in a sense based on Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep, like The Big Lebowski, like The Big Sleep. And they said, just like that film, he said that the people who are making The Big Sleep, I don't think they even understood what the story was. But it doesn't matter if you don't understand the complications of the plot, that it's essentially an episodic storytelling method. But I hadn't thought that there is that unifying factor, that they are always trying to get back to the bowling alley. That's their happy place. But more consequentially, in light of the analysis that you just gave at the top, it's that place where they feel in control, or they have that kind of control that is talked about in that ball games as symbols chapter. So,
I submit this film is super popular. This is not a film. This is not just Gus T. Renegade. The Library of Congress selected this film in their, and I mean, it's a very small group. They have less than 1,000 films that they have placed in their National Film Registry. The Big Lebowski is one of those films that they deem to be culturally relevant enough that the Library of Congress has saved this film. Tons of people, including previously mentioned Eva Mendes, has stated that this is on her top 5 film list of all time. Talib Kweli just did a symposium on this film alone for a group of students up in New York. Hugely popular film for a variety of reasons. It's not like it did really well at the box office. It's one of those that did okay and then has just grown into a legend since the time of its release. I think there are a lot of really popular lines that have been taken from this film. That's like your opinion, man. I think that's the Dude's line. I think that one became really tons of really popular lines and cultural references. When I told Dr. Kevorkian the 4 films that I wanted to check out, you said this was the only film you'd seen, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Have you seen this film? Go ahead, sorry.
Yes, I had seen this film, and I mean, I'll confess, when I saw it out, I remember enjoying it when I first saw it. And so it's really something to come back to it in a different context. But it's, I mean, there's no way of overstating the kind of cultural impact that this film has had, as you've indicated. I mean, there's, you know, I just went to the library. I mean, there's a ton of books just written about this. You know, there's the standard kind of making of, but then there's one from the British Film Institute on film classics. It's a whole book called The Big Lebowski. You know, it's a film classic. There's another book called I'm a Lebowski, You're a Lebowski. And, I mean, I think that's something we need to interrogate, you know, who are the people who are saying I'm a Lebowski, you're a Lebowski? Who are the people who are identifying so powerfully with it? There's a book called The Big Lebowski and Philosophy. And, in fact, it's got an entire chapter on that line that you just quoted. That's just like your opinion, man, and spinning that out as a profound philosophy. The one that I found kind of most amusing is actually the sixth book that I saw on the shelf. It's called The Year's Work in Lebowski Studies.
Wow.
So this just came out in 2009, and it's a 488-page book packed with articles analyzing the Big Lebowski just from that year. I mean, they didn't do one every year, so that's kind of the joke of it, but still, it's quite a testament to its popularity. When I went back and saw it again, one of the things that attracted my attention was I just saw it in the theater once, and so I went to the special features, and they had a thing that said this was a 10-year anniversary edition of the film, and it said some of the things like we've been saying it wasn't that popular, but then it really caught on as a cult phenomenon. Jeff Bridges says, it's got a lot of support from the little urban achievers. And I thought that's just really weird. But I thought he was just making a joke. But in fact, there are people who call themselves that and who have appropriated that term. There was another documentary that they excerpted in the special features. It was called Achiever Lebowski Fest, and it's a self-applied term. And I also want to say one of the things that Julianne Moore says about it, Jeff Bridges is saying there's a lot of support among little urban achievers, but what Julianne Moore, the demographic she points to, people who are always kind of calling out to her and identifying with the film, she says it seems to really appeal to frat guys. John Turturro makes a joke that says there's a bunch of college kids not going to class. And he says that's why our society is in crisis. And he's kind of making a joke. But that, on the other hand, it's a film that's all about kind of getting away with and celebrating irresponsible behavior. But this achiever, the Lebowski Fest, they do talk about that this is a self-applied term, the little urban achiever. The little urban achievers, if you haven't seen the film, are kids from Watts who supposedly the Big Lebowski has a charity that is supposed to be benefiting them. And he actually ends up stealing $1 million from that fund that is supposed to benefit these children from Watts. And that's one of the unresolved things of the film is that, as far as I can tell, he gets away with stealing their money. But in any case, there are people who call themselves achievers, but they had lots of footage from the Lebowski Fest. I think it started in 2002 in Louisville, Kentucky. And then it went to various places, Seattle, Las Vegas, Los Angeles. But if you look at the people attending these Lebowski Fests, it's overwhelmingly young white men. So it's a very strange thing. These young white men quoting movies from The Big Lebowski, but calling themselves, achievers after those little urban achievers. You also mentioned that there's like always a racist joke in these. There's kind of a very strange racist joke built into this documentary, because you find near the end of it that the whole thing was the documentary itself. Was directed by an Asian American man, and he makes a joke. He says, "I'm the Chinaman with the camera." And so there's several sort of jokes about using the term Chinaman or using the term Chinaman incorrectly in the movie as a kind of a politically incorrect term. Here he's kind of making light of it, but on the other hand, he's in a very interesting way documenting the way the dude abides, the way the dude has become this dominant model for a certain sector of youthful male white culture. Very, very few. There's maybe in the whole documentary, they might see one non-white person and a few women, but it's mostly men. I'll say, also just from the very beginning of the film, when they're just showing pictures of people bowling one after another, I think the first guy they show is a fairly hefty white man. And I think they make a point to try to show you then after that some non-white bowlers to give the suggestion that, well, it's not just white bowling culture that we're talking about. But when you look at the reception of the film and the way it is venerated, at least as far as I know, at least as far as I can tell from these materials, that's the sector of the population that has most embraced Lebowski.
Yeah, I would agree. And the little Lebowski urban achievers, that is another racist joke I would say in the film, because there are not a whole lot of black characters in the film, but mm-hmm. you can see that they got black children to stand in for the photo for the little Lebowski urban achievers. And then, talk about appropriation, that's the title that they use for people who say they're fans of the film or with this, that they are achievers. And I've even seen paraphernalia, they have lots of paraphernalia with this film, but I've even seen shirts that have little Lebowski urban achievers. People are going out and wearing that, just continuing the joke. And even the Chinaman segment, I was going to say that's another racist joke in the film, where it's said, and it gets questioned in the film about, well, you shouldn't say that. And then they just continue to use it. I can give folks a term. I used to work at a comedy club, and it's callback. Comedians, when they tell a joke, they give it to you one time. So they give maybe joke A, and they continue telling their other jokes. And then by the time they get to joke M, they will do a callback that is referencing joke A. They'll just do it again and be, oh, ha, 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 and you get your laugh. They have that in The Big Lebowski. They do, Chinaman has said, the dude, and even that, just looking at that, the dude and Walter, very beginning of the film, the dude is attacked, the misunderstanding between the dude and The Big Lebowski, because they have the same name, and they leave. But he gets attacked by a white male and a non-white Asian male. The white male throws his head in the toilet, curses at him, messes up his house. Asian male pees on his rug. All of his animosity is focused on the Asian male. He never says anything about the white guy who throws his head in the toilet, drops the bowling ball. It never says anything about that. Everything is focused on Chinaman peed on my rug. Chinaman peed on my rug. And genital level, going back to Dr. Welsing, non-white male whose genitals I do not have control on. In fact, he used his genitals to violate me. Go to the bowling alley for sanctuary about all of this. He gets corrected. Walter tells him, you shouldn't be saying Chinaman, stop saying that. They continue saying it. 5 minutes later in the film, the callback.
I hope that someday my wife will learn to live on her allowance, which is ample. But if she does not, that is her problem, not mine. Just as the rug is your problem. Just as every bum's lot in life is his own responsibility, regardless of who he chooses to blame. I didn't blame anyone for the loss of my legs. Some Chinaman took them from me in Korea, but I went out and achieved anyway.
And they have, that's a double joke, because it's a Chinaman in Korea. So they're doing two racist jokes at once. And the callback, because they just said that 5 minutes ago about not saying Chinaman and just making light of all of it. And again, in my view, that is a part of the appeal of these films. The racist jokes, why you have so many young white people who appreciate these films. Racist jokes are always, always, always in vogue, regardless of, you know, the whites that we've had come on this program who say that they cannot remember a racist joke, or even though they've heard a thousand. We have literally had white people come on this program and say they've heard 1,000 racist jokes, but they can't remember one to tell us live on the air. But super important, should not be glossed over, in my opinion, that popping up so early in the film. The character John Turturro, he is Santana in the film. Really important. I have a sound clip with all of that. Before I play the sound clip, I guess number one, Santana, the character, do you think he's classified as white or not white?
I think he's classified as non-white in this character. I mean, the Coen brothers talk about the fact, sort of a strange thing, they said, we knew we wanted Turturro to play a Hispanic role for us at some point, and we're just looking for it. in like a making of interview, they say that they actually saw him in kind of a community theater production in which he had played Hispanic character, and one in that one, in that play that they had seen him, he had played someone who might have been a child molester, and that gave them the idea of maybe for casting him that way in this film. But yeah, they wanted him to be outrageous, and they definitely had in mind for his character to be read as Hispanic. That was the way that they talked about the role.
Wow. That, in my opinion, very important, because, again, there are not very many non-white characters in this film at all. Very few black people, particularly with like a speaking role, where you get to see them more than once or they say anything. It's pretty much white people, mostly white males, from beginning to end. So to have him be one of the few non-white people who actually gets something to say, and he gets to repeatedly come back in the frame, and he is a child rapist. And they even make the point of, they visualize, they, Walter narrates and says he is a child rapist. He had to register as a sex offender and then go door to door to tell people that he was a sex offender in the area. And they even cut away. That's why I said the plot doesn't really matter, because it just rambles at every moment. Anytime, you know, they feel like deviating, that's what it does. Dream sequences or whatever it does. But so they cut away and they show him walking door to door, and they even, you know, try to make his penis look really large. He's wearing tight jeans as he's walking to the door to say, yes, you have a child rapist here. In my view, that is gargantuan, that is the representation of black masculinity, particularly keeping in mind what Dr. Welsing said, control of non-white testicles, that child rapists in the vicinity, and they even talked about that, how they made it a point to accentuate his genital area when he went to go to the door to say that he was a child molester, when Walter was kind of narrating that story. Is that significant?
Yeah, and again, the person that he answers the door is a very large white dude, right?
Right.
Large, hairy-looking white dude. So there's this idea that the scene of his humiliation here is that maybe he's going to, I don't know if he's going to get, you're supposed to imagine, like, he's going to be frightened by this guy or beaten up by this guy, but that he is sort of abasing himself by having to say this in front of a white man. It's not some other ethnicity that he's informing this information to. So the scene plays out in that contrast between him as this very skinny non-white character, and then this big, muscular, powerful white character, very intimidating, dominates the frame for just that moment when you see him.
I think even with Turturro, I think it's also important. I'm reminded of James Baldwin's comment where he says, in the system of white supremacy, you're often black male seen as just a walking phallus, where John Turturro, in addition to, he's a rapist immediately, a child rapist, not just a rapist in need of castration, which does get mentioned in this film a lot. He has some sort of black instrument on his hand. It's supposed to be something, I guess, to bowl, but it also just very much another phallic symbol to me, because it's like coal black on his finger when he does his little celebration thing when he is first introduced, when they're talking about all the bad things that he's done with his penis. You talked about in the documentary how it was a lot of young white guys, a lot of young frat guys, it seems, that this film appeals to, and a lot of the commentary that I've read, they also have said that this seems to have a huge enduring appeal to white males, and that's the bulk of the folks that are in the film. I'm not even going to set this up. I'm just going to say it in this manner and then play the clip. This clip is a little bit longer, but it's to make a point, getting back to what Dr. Welsing had to say, and just to remind folks that we did spend, I think, 2 months listening to the late Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism Within U.S. Slave Culture. I'll just say the name of the book one more time, and then I'll play the clip, which again is about 3 minutes. Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture.
And tomorrow we come back and we cut off your Johnson.
Excuse me?
I said we cut off your Johnson!
Just think about that Lebowski.
Ah, you're big, Lebowski.
Maybe stomp on it and squish it.
My only hope is that the big Lebowski kills me before the Germans can cut my dick off.
Now that is just ridiculous, dude. No one's going to cut your dick off.
Thank you, Walter.
Not if I have anything to say about it.
Thank you, Walter. That makes me feel very secure.
Dude.
That makes me feel very warm inside.
Dude.
Fucking thing. I could be sitting here with just pee stains on my rug.
Yeah.
But no, man, I gotta,
fucking,
you know.
Germans. Nothing changes. Fucking Nazis.
They were Nazis, dude?
Oh, come on, Donnie. They were threatening castration.
I don't need your fucking sympathy, man. I need my fucking Johnson.
What do you need that for, dude?
You have got to buck up, man. We know that this is your homework.
I'm gonna cut your dick off, Larry.
You're killing your father, Larry.
Son, this is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass!
Language problem here. Little prick stonewalling me.
Walter! What are you doing, man? What are you doing?
Here you go, Larry. You see what happens? You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens? This is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass, Larry! This is what happens, Larry. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass? This is what happens. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens, Larry, when you fuck a stranger in the ass? This is what happens, Larry. This is what happens, Larry. This is what happens, Larry.
What the fuck are you doing, man?
I would have fucked you in the ass Saturday. I'll fuck you in the ass the next Wednesday instead.
Woo! You got a dead Wednesday, baby.
Show me what you got, nihilist.
I fuck you!
Walter, come on, he's got a sword thing, man.
Fucking dipshit with a nine-toed woman.
I fuck you! Fuck you! I fuck you! I fix this!
Context of White Supremacy. I'll say the book title one more time, The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism Within U.S. Slave Culture. Vincent Woodard, we spent about two months, on the book club reading through that book, which had a profound impact. In my view, the homoeroticism in The Big Lebowski is pretty flagrant. That was why I wanted to just put all of the different comments that you hear throughout the film all together so you can kind of get a concentrated dose of that. Do you think the homoeroticism that's in the film, do you think that's a part of the appeal that this film has to particularly young white males or white males in general?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, it seems like it would have to. I mean, when you put it all together like that, it seems like that's the only thing that's in the film. But I'm trying to think about the idea that it seemed obvious to me seeing it at first that it was very much about masculinity. And in some ways, it can be taken as sort of a mockery or various kinds of failures of kinds of white masculinity. I certainly think that, looking back on the film, the Walter trashing the Corvette and shouting at the kid, it was one of the more memorable things in it. And it seemed in that case to play out as a kind of dramatization of Walter's powerlessness, even while he's desperately trying to assert this kind of violent and vulgar masculinity. I think that just the reiteration of those lines, there must be something about it that has an appeal. And I I can't claim to understand how that works, but the clip is there, yeah. The super clip.
Dr. Welsing's commentary, I think, just going back to what she said, such domination can be established and maintained only if white males and females, the total white collective, control all of the balls, testicles of non-white men off and on the playing fields and ball courts. In other words, the name of the real game, the power game, is continuous worldwide control of the testicles of all non-white men by white males and females. And I think in terms of the homoerotic nature of it, the focus is on the genitals. But even the bonds that are formed seem to be around white males with other white males in bonding and trying to restore their sense of lost power. It's like Walter and the dude are uniting to avenge the Chinaman who has used his genitals to violate the dude's rugs. Like, we're going to join forces to make everything right in the world. Like, there is no male-female union in the film. Even the Big Lebowski, his character, his wife is gone. She left voluntarily, and he's not even trying to get her back. Like, he's just trying to rob money from the Little Achievers Fund. The dude, even though he does end up having intercourse with Maude Lebowski, Julia Ann Moore's character, she state like explicitly, this is not like a boyfriend girlfriend thing. He says it later in the film as well. She's not my special lady. She's just my lady friend. She's certainly not like Walter. But there is no male female union or bond in the film. All of the bonding that you see in the film, it's males bonding with other males. It's the Big Lebowski bonding with Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. It's the dude bonding with Walter and Steve Buscemi's character. That's throughout the film. And I think that I was going to have a sound clip, Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, in her book, The History of White People, she was a guest on the program in 2010. We had an extensive conversation about how, if you look back throughout the history of white culture, the history of white people, there is a strong dominant theme of homoeroticism way before Vincent Woodard's work on slave culture in the United States. But she talks about how Greco-Roman society, and that's in the dream sequence in The Big Society, where they're all dressed in their togas and what have you, doing their bowling. But Dr. Nell Irvin Painter, she talks about how that was a society that was certainly homosocial, certainly homoerotic, and white males bonding with and being around other white males. And that theme seems to carry strongly through today. I would submit that has to be a huge part of the appeal of this film, because it's such a dominant element. I don't think you can get very far in the film without just seeing lots and lots of white males being around each other and rejoicing, being in their own company. Is this lucid, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that surprised me the most in reviewing it, is to what extent all the white males in this film end up being in some kind of brotherhood, however trouble, some kind of bond together. I sort of remembered it as a study of contrast, like the joke being that the dude is nothing like the Big Lebowski. But for example, I remember, looking back in the film, I remember the line about the Chinaman took my legs from me in Korea. But I hadn't remembered that the dude had also used the word Chinaman. Right. So they're both part of this same racist joke culture, even though the Big Lebowski would say the dude is nothing like me, and vice versa. Superficially, in certain kind of styles, they're different, but they're part of this same white brotherhood. Most obviously it ends with Walter and the dude finally hugging over Donnie's death and embracing one another in this loving way. In a similar way, it seemed to me like the movie was supposed to be this study in contrast, how the dude is laid back and nothing like Walter, and yet they have a loving bond that is established between them, despite their supposedly very different ways of going about things. And again, it's about this kind of brotherhood that insists on, I think, the kind of control that is being talked about in that, again, that, I'm citing it already, that ball games as symbols. One of the things Walter says when he's brandishing the gun in the bowling alley He says, this is not Nam, this is bullying. There are rules. So he's insisting on bullying as this ideal space where everything goes by the rules, and he's going to enforce that violently as necessary. But I think the other thing that's implicit in that, we said this is not Nam, this is bullying. That implies that when it comes to aggression against Asians or aggression against non-whites, there perhaps are no rules. The rule is that there are no rules. So he wants to control everything within the ball game, but when it comes time to express aggression towards Asians, the rules can be broken with impunity by the same brotherhood. And you see again these guys again, you know, Walter brandishing the gun, getting away with it. The Big Lebowski stealing the money, getting away with it. The Kid stealing the car and getting away with it. And even, you know, supposedly the big face-off scene where they go and confront the Big Lebowski, Walter pulls him out of his wheelchair, but then the dude finally says, let's help put him back in his wheelchair. There's even kind of a reconciliation there. They all, you know, one guy picks up, the other guy throws him down, then they both get together and pick him up and put him back together. So I was struck by the nature of that warmly constituted white brotherhood.
What did you make of the scene where the dude, after he gets arrested and he gets kicked out of the Malibu Police Department, he's in the cab, black guy's driving the cab, one of the few black people you see in the film, and the black guy throws him out of the cab after the dude complains about the Eagles. He doesn't like the radio station playing the Eagles music. And the black guy tells him, if you don't like my music, you can get another cab. And so the dude explains, like, I just don't like the Eagles. The black guy promptly pulls over and grabs him and physically throws him out of his cab. What did you make of that scene?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those figures. I mean, that the dude earlier also encounters a non-white man or a black man that he encounters somewhat as a figure of just annoyance. There's the cab driver, but you know, unless I'm thinking of the wrong
Santana, film, I guess he would count. They don't seem to like him.
The Coen brothers describe him as a nemesis of Lebowski, but also sort of the first time. He files the police report that seems like there's a non-white police officer and who's not helping him out, who's not going to pursue this, who the dude doesn't think is taking this matter sufficiently seriously. And therefore, the dude has to take things into his own hands. We'll see that again in that's the dynamic, I think, that anticipates the logic that we see, and don't feel at home anymore. But I think you see a version of that disrespect towards the non-white person in the cab driver and in the police officer, both of whom the dude sees as not strange. It was signified, but again, and you know, particularly the cab driver is dressed in, I don't know if you tried, but he's got a kind of a black leather cap on.
Right.
And I don't know if he was wearing anything else that would signify maybe black nationalism, but he was seemed to be coded as someone that would be aligned with something like black power or the power of the black man, and the dude expresses again nothing but irritation and disrespect for the way this guy is going through the world.
I thought they did that. It just seems so conspicuous to me, just because there's so few black people in the film, period. And then to have this happen, where I think it's almost a cliche now that a black person cannot get a cab. And so to have it inverted where the black guy is throwing the dude out of the cab and over the music, I think that's another cliche, too. Don't touch a black person's radio. And even though he's not playing hip hop or anything like that, he's playing the Eagles, which is supposed to be another joke in there. But that's what he gets thrown off for. I think that almost might be another racist joke right there with the layers on it. But it felt very conspicuous the way that they set that scene up kind of in the latter part of the film. Their religions even have been based off of the dude. I think there's one, the Tao of the dude and some others. This is another one just like the previous film where I don't think Luke's character could be a black person and you could have that film. This is another one. I do not think you could make this film and have the dude be, pick a black person, Mr. Ali, Denzel Washington. I do not think this film is, you could do this with a black person and it would be the same type of, I don't know what it would look like, but I cannot imagine it being a Library of Congress choice of one of the most important films that's ever been produced. Could you see the dude being a black person?
I mean, no, it'd be different. It'd be a different film. It'd be a different film for sure. Yeah. It's, I mean, there's, Even to the point that he, you know, continually on order. So.
Oh, I don't know if it's break. I don't know if my line is breaking up. I did not hear the last word. I guess if you could give me another sentence just to make sure my line is clear.
Oh, sure. No, I was affirming that it would be a very different film. And I mean, I'm just thinking of things like where the dude walks in the bars and says, another Caucasian, Gary. I mean, that's a kind of joke. I'm not sure how funny it is, but it's this white guy that continually is ordering his favorite drink is called the Caucasian. I mean, if you made that with a black main character, it would just be a very different kind of a line.
I noted that. I told one of our listeners that when I mentioned this film, they too said they had seen this film years ago and never given it a second thought. And, you know, we're kind of perplexed as to why I would pick a film like this anyway. And when they watched it the second time around, they said that stood out. I think White Russian is the drink that he gets, mixture of Kahlua, vodka, and milk. I think Dr. Welsing would probably have something to say about that too. But that's his drink, and he gets like, I think, 9 of it. I almost made a sound clip running together all of the different white, and it's it has two names. It's the same drink, but it has two names: White Russian, Caucasian, both of them signifying white race. And it just how many times he says it, like even he goes to Jackie Treehorn's. He orders a White Russian. Jackie Treehorn repeats it. So he's White Russian, White Russian. He goes and gets it, and then he gives him another one. And he says it again. Like, even it was said so many times, it stood out as being conspicuous to me within the whole context of reevaluate. Even I saw online where even some people were questioning why he's continuing to order these White Russians, Caucasians throughout the film. He's got even a little shrine in his house with his Kahlua and all the beverages he needs to concoct his Caucasian. Anything else stood out from the film before we move to I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore?
Yeah, well, of the non-white person, which is that, as I said, I think it's a lot about trying to think about masculinity. I mean, there's that line between the dude and the Big Lebowski, where the Big Lebowski, the old man, is saying, you know, what makes a man? Is it the willingness to do whatever is necessary, do what is right, whatever is necessary? Schools again, Oliver.
Seems I'm still getting some distortion in my line. I'm going to disconnect myself and just ring back in before I get to the next film, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. Transitioning, we were moving from The Big Lebowski to I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, which came out this year. All the films, the last two films that we're doing are much more recent this year. 2006, or excuse me, last year, 2000, excuse me, confuse my films. I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore came out this year, 2017. This film, I watched. It's connected to the film that we're going to talk about last. But I found this same process as I told you before. I just went to see what was popular on Netflix. I don't watch a whole lot of films. Reading is more important than watching television. I checked to see what was popular on Netflix, and this was one of the most popular, most highly rated films on Netflix this year. This film was released directly to Netflix, unless I've been misinformed. Melanie Lynskey, Elijah Wood. Elijah Wood is famous for playing Harry Potter for all of those years. Those are the main two characters in the film. In fact, this is supposed to be yours to give us our synopsis. So, Dr. Gworkian, you can take it away, 3 minutes or less.
Okay, I don't feel at home in this world anymore. It's a story that focuses initially on Melanie Lynskey, and she seems to be cast as someone for whom we're supposed to sort of feel sympathy and feel bad for the way that the world is difficult for her to negotiate. And she suffers various indignities, and including being a victim of a home burglary. And she doesn't get satisfaction from law enforcement, so she has to kind of take things into her own hands. And she hooks up with Elijah Wood, who's a very strange, another kind of very violent outsider character. And they kind of act as vigilantes to try to get justice for her. And again, the very strange thing about the film is it seems like a series of really, really bad ideas, the kinds of actions that they take together. And yet in the end, they come out of this and survive, and he emerges as kind of this glowing, almost white savior figure. At the end of the movie, sort of bathed in this halo. When what you've been seeing is a bunch of violent and illegal and ill-advised actions. So, I mean, we can get into the analysis, but to me, it's another movie about vigilantism, being outside of the law, and kind of selling to audiences the kind of the vicarious satisfaction of moving from being this meek person who lets things happen to her to becoming the person who, instead of getting cut in front of in line at the supermarket, will now cut in front of someone else. That was a kind of a strange thing to make you feel like, oh, this character is really making progress. Now she's committing the same injustice that used to annoy her. So that's what I saw her character arc as being.
And stealing lawn tigers. With this film, I read one of the reviews and they said, this is like Falling Down. People saw it from the early 90s. Michael Douglas is a white male. He works for the Department of Defense, and he just one day goes berserk and accosts lots of non-white people, basically. But there are a few white people in between. But initially, it's lots of non-white people that he goes through and accosts and goes on this rampage throughout the day. And I've seen that film, very popular film, important, lots of racial dynamics there as they are with most films. But that is not the film this reminded me of. I said that I think within the first time that I saw this, I said, this reminds me of The Big Lebowski. Like Elijah Wood's character is basically Walter, and Ruth is like, the dude is not abiding anymore. Even though there are a lot, in my view, quite a few similarities between them, but a lot of the sequencing. In fact, when I pulled back a little further, I said, the folks who did I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, I suspect they are Coen Brother fans. This film, to me, is like Fargo and Big Lebowski put together. Fargo is the film that the Coen Brothers did directly before The Big Lebowski, and it's very similar in terms of they would call it kind of a dark comedy, lots of violence in that film. But if you put those, The Big Lebowski and Fargo together, very similar to I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, in my opinion. But I just Elijah Wood's character and John Goodman, like, wow, they even look, except he's a little bit smaller, which fits, I think, what they're trying to do with the film. But how does that sound to you, Dr. Kevorkian, and the similarities between those works?
That's stunning. I mean, I saw I Don't Feel at Home first, and then I went back and saw The Big Lebowski, and I missed that. But I'm looking at the picture of Elijah Wood right now, and he is Walter. He's got the exact same glasses, those yellow-tinted kind of, I don't know if you'd use them for a firing shooting range or something, kind of glasses, hunting glasses. And he's got that same attitude that, you know, violence at the drop of a hat. But you're right. Again, Melanie Lynskey, I love that line. The dude is not abiding anymore. She's fed up and she's impatient. But again, I the connection that I did see to The Big Lebowski is very early on. There's a scene where she goes to the police department, and specifically it's a non-white, it's a black officer, and he is portrayed as being unsympathetic to her.
Oh, we got a clip. We got a clip. I thought that was important. Okay. We got a clip for that.
Okay.
Just before we get to the clip, I want to make sure I get this, because this was in the first 30 seconds of the movie. When I watched this,
oh, dear.
I had seen Little Boxes already, okay? When I first sat down to watch this, I did not know Melanie Lynskey was also in this film. Melanie Lynskey is also in the film that we're going to talk about last. I didn't know that until the film started playing. Then there's a racist joke in the first 60 seconds of this movie. Immediately, I said, oh, man, we have a film show now. This is in the first 60 seconds of the movie. If you're not watching closely, I could see how you could miss this and just, you know, think whatever you think about the movie. You don't think it's a racist joke. You just move on. This is pivotal. In my view, this might even get to the core of what this movie is all about. The movie comes on. I'm just giving context because you won't have the visual cues for folks that are listening. The movie comes on. There's a white female patient in a hospital bed. That's where Ruth works. The TV is on. On the television, they have what to me looks like the Ferguson protests. This movie came out this year, but that's what it looks like to me. If it's not the Ferguson protest, it looks like black people in the streets protesting some form of police violence or police corruption. That's what's on the television. And then it goes from there. I think you all can pick it up there. This is only like 44 seconds, but this is the very beginning of I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore.
Just look at this goddamn piece.
Why do we turn this off, huh?
The way they shove this country right down the fucking stinker. Keep your gigantic monkey dick out of my good pussy.
Did you have any last words?
The significance of giving the... I could have stopped it right after she gave her last words and dies. So she... Take your monkey penis out of my good... Blah, blah, blah. I could have stopped it right there, but it goes on. They show her white family, and it is a black doctor. And were there any last words? And so they look at the nurse, who is Melanie Lynskey, and she doesn't say anything. They let that other joke go. Now, in my view, for this film to come out this year in 2017, right after that guy was elected talking about make this country great again, it sounds like she would have voted for him. Looking at the protesters, calling them monkeys, man, Planet of the Apes just came out a couple weeks ago. We've talked about that. That's one of the oldest racist tropes in the history of white supremacy. Black people as monkeys and gorillas and apes and all of that. But monkeys are putting this country in the stinker, and you're not going to put your monkey penis in my good. She doesn't say white, but I think that's implied. We still got the focus on the genitals of non-white people, and then she dies. Stunning for this movie, in my view, to start that way, because it sounds like she has some of the exact same angst and frustration that Ruth's character, Melanie Lynskey, that she is going to have for the duration of the film, except she never ties her angst and frustration to black people until it gets to that scene with the cop later in the film. I'll stop there. Does any of this make sense, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's It's one of those movies that it in one level, it reminded me of the very beginning of a film that we talked about before, which was As Good As It Gets. Another one of those films where, you know, some people might not remember it as having racist content to it, but then there's a racial joke and the main character, Jack Nicholson, saying something crass and racist along, you know, those lines in the very first few seconds of the film. So you could just decide to just turn it off at that point. I mean, it's just what the old white woman here is saying is it's like it couldn't be more offensive, but it's a little different in that in this case it's a character who immediately dies, but then, as you point out, in a strange way, you know, the main character that we are going to be stuck with does take up some of that resentful logic. I also wanted to comment in light of something you said earlier about kind of the process of sanitization that can take place, that it's certainly worth noting that given this opportunity to say something, Linsky says nothing. I mean, I don't know what you would say in that situation. You wouldn't want to ever requote, you know, what was said. And later, when she has a conversation about this woman with the Elijah Wood character, she says, oh, yeah, she was horrible, you know, this woman who died. But there is a way in which her horrible last words are, you know, erased from the record, you know, that she gets to have died a peaceful death rather than sort of revealing this deep-seated racial hatred that she carried with her.
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. Sorry.
I was just going to say deep-seated racial hatred that she probably carried towards her black physician as well. Continue, Dr. Kevorkian. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I say. You see, again, these. I mean, it plays right into that same sort of election scenario that you're talking about. You have, you know, foregrounded black characters in powerful roles of status, the black doctor, and then the black police detective, and then white characters who are harboring a kind of resentment towards the perception that blacks are gaining status or becoming middle class. These sorts of things are kind of triggering the spewing of bile by the old woman. But I just want to say that there's, you know, you already cited another one of the imagery, but there's a lot of animal imagery that comes up in these films. As you said, it's the monkeys from the beginning. It's the lawn tigers later on. I might have wanted to read just a quotation. This is a piece of literary analysis, and this is writing about Edgar Allan Poe and his poem The Raven. That is this blackbird that haunts the narrator and keeps quoting this word again and again, annoyingly, nevermore, nevermore, and kind of is driving the narrator crazy. Interesting article. The article is called The Poetics of Whiteness, Poe and the Racial Imaginary. It's by Betsy Urkula. And it starts out with a quotation from Invisible Man, which is, I am not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe. It's from the opening lines of Invisible Man. But Urkel is also making the point that, yes, Edgar Allan Poe was not haunted by, or the Invisible Man is not a ghost, right? But in a sense, Poe was haunted by a kind of racial fear. And here's what she says about the Raven. She says, I want to suggest that the ghastly figure of the blackbird evokes the fear of racial mixture and the fear of sexual violation of the white woman by the black man that was at the center of antebellum debates about the future of white America. I think that ends the quote. Bass. And I think that same logic comes through in that clip you played.
Wow. I think that anxiety will come up again in the film that we're going to talk about next as well. But
yes.
Wow. Yeah, with this film, I don't know why this film was, as I said, that's how I found it. This was one of the top rated films on Netflix. I don't know what aspect is appealing. My suspicion would have to be that it seems there are a lot of these types of films and TV shows that have been popular since the Obama days. Breaking Bad comes to mind, and others where you have whites who feel that they have been shortchanged, that they have missed out. They're disgruntled with seeing black people in certain positions or just the way things are, and they're upset. It seems like there are a lot more of these types of films coming out, and apparently a good portion of people resonated with this project. I think Elijah Wood is pretty popular. I don't know about Melanie Lynskey, but she's been on a lot of projects as well. I guess specifically before I get to the scene that you were mentioning where she confronts the black detective, what do you make of the scene when Ruth, that's her name, Melanie Linsky's character, Ruth, when she goes to the house with Tony, that's Elijah Wood's character, Ruth and Tony go to the house to get her laptop first. She has all these items stolen from her house by this crew of white drug addict criminals, low-level criminals. And the first item she goes to get back is her computer. And the house where her laptop is, it's a black male, black female, white woman, white man are at the residence where they go and get the computer back after a minor conflict. I had a color monitors moment that, of course, they have the black male seated at the computer when she comes in to recoup her stolen property. What did you make of the racial dynamics of that scene?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That any sort of potential threat of the black male presence is contained by the fact that he's sitting over the computer, very much a color monitors moment, whereas there's the looming figure of the white male who is presented as the sort of the more the physical threat in that situation. I have to confess, I kind of gave the film a little credit at this point for tricking me because I was thinking, okay, now she's really found the robbers, right? And I said, oh, well, they've cast the black man as not just the techno expert, but also the criminal and the thief. But then it turns out that they kind of pull the rug on that one. And no, it turns out he wasn't the criminal, and he insists, and actually, you know, he paid good money for it. And so the way it plays out, it says, even though he paid for this thing, no one objects to it, ultimately to her just taking it and going. I mean, he's getting a bum deal out of this, but no one seems to question that. He wasn't the one who stole it. But I don't know if that makes sense. I say that I kind of give it credit for tricking me. I mean, it made me think that, you know, I was playing into this stereotype of, oh, of course, this is the group of actual criminals. But then he reveals that the real criminals were, as you say, these kind of low-level white thugs, not the multicultural team that we first see and first are set up to think of as the robbers.
Definitely a color monitors moment there for folks who read the book or heard our previous discussion. Before I get to that scene with Ruth and the black detective that happens a little later in the film, I need to set this scene up because when I watched it, by the time the scene comes up, I had already concluded, like, oh, wow, this was way more than I thought, and we should talk about this on the program. So this scene was just kind of the icing on the cake by this point. But when I first saw this scene, I immediately thought of one of your previous visits, because we've had this conversation before about scenes coming up in films where white characters are asking and or demanding help, assistance from black people. We talked about this specifically with Black Mirror, and this is what you said in the context of Black Mirror, white characters asking for help.
What were your thoughts about the San Junipero episode, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, I thought there was, this is one of the episodes I had in mind when I said that there's a real asymmetry or sort of injustice in the treatment of the white and the black characters. This is one of the episodes that gets talked about the most as being another one of those episodes that's an upbeat episode for the American audience. It's got this warm, 80s nostalgia to it. They even talk about what's called an immersive nostalgia therapy. And one of the white video game players talks about 1980 as a golden age. And that there's maybe even a little bit of the Make America Great Again, like Donald Trump wanting to go back to whenever his heyday was, whenever he thought his golden age was. I don't know. But yes, particularly, I believe you said this is Jamie who wrote in. Is that?
Yes, sir.
And Jamie who sparked this whole conversation. I want to read one line that just stuck out to me. This is Yorkie, the white woman, speaking to Kelly, who's the black woman who is introducing her to expanding her experiences. It's yet another version of the help me. There's the help me in White Bear. There's the help me demand in Noseside. But this is another one that's framed as a demand. Yorkie says, just help me. Can you just make this easy for me? Right? Here the white woman expects the black woman to do the work of expediting her fantasy. So even in that way, it's like playtest, where the white guy expects the black woman to hook him up to this gear and have him play this really great immersive horror game. It doesn't turn out that way for him, but there's this expectation that the black character is going to make things happen. And she doesn't ask. She says, just help me. That's a command. And then she later says, you have to show me, right? You have to show me is different than saying, please show me. Would you please show me? I'd like you to show me.
Okay. Now that was Dr. Kevorkian. We were talking about Black Mirror. This is the scene that I immediately placed with the segment that you just heard. This is from I Don't Feel at Home Anymore. Ruth, white woman, she goes to the police department after she's done all of this searching vigilante efforts with her partner, Tony. They made a mold of a footprint of the person that they think broke into their residence, and they've got a license plate, and she's actually seen this person now. So she's, hey, I got all this information. You should go track this guy down. This is the guy who broke into my house. It turns out she is correct. This is one of the white people that broke into her residence to steal her items. So this is that scene, context of white supremacy.
Wow. That's something. That's something. What do you do, Miss Kimke?
I'm a nursing assistant.
Now, suppose I came down to where you do that. The hospital.
It's a post-op facility.
Okay. But suppose I came down there and I said, you know, maybe not that medication, Ruth. Maybe this one instead, don't you think?
No, that's not what I meant.
You present a certainty that the owner of a vehicle you happen to see at a garage sale is the same individual who burglarized your home. And that his foot, according to this, is made out of scrambled eggs.
No. No, sir, that is not... Okay, so... I located my
computer. Right, I understand the chain of events as you tell them.
Okay.
Did it not occur to you that the people who had your computer in the first place were the same ones that broke into your home?
Yeah, but...
Occam's razor and whatnot.
Yeah, what?
Did it not occur to you that approaching a criminal suspect without official capacity is a good way to get your wig knocked off? Let me see your hand. Can I see it?
Nothing.
Can I see it? That's what I thought. Yeah. What happened to your finger? Ruth, look at me. Were you engaged in a confrontation?
No, it was an accident.
Have you been able to replace your medications?
I see.
I'll take that as a no.
Okay. I mean, why do you not want to help me?
Help me?
Yeah, isn't it your job?
A job?
Yeah,
I am doing my job.
You're asking me about my job right now?
Yeah, I'm coming in here.
You come into my workplace and you ask me about my job?
Mm-hmm.
You think just because you left your door wide open for some punk to stroll right in that the universe now somehow revolves around you? Well, grow up. We had a man beaten unconscious in his driveway.
That's awful.
Now, yes, awful. And now, Ruth, he has skull fragments in his brain. The world is bigger than your silverware. People are experiencing bigger problems. There are people out there. I'm being divorced. First time I said it out loud.
Sir, I'm very...
Move it. Move that hand. Go home, Ruth.
This is the guy.
No, it is not. And if you engage in vigilante action or mess around with this again, I will be a bigger problem than your busted finger. Do you follow me?
Context of white supremacy. Some moron goes around here saying on a regular basis one thing that would help end white supremacy if non-white people stopped helping white people. Your thoughts on that scene, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, I mean, it's a scene that, you know, he's building up and he's saying a lot of things that have this powerful resonance of truth, and you think, you know, he's it starts out, I think, portraying unsympathetically in the way that he speaks with sarcasm about, you know, making these comparisons about going to her work versus going to his work. But then when he gets to the point where he's saying, you know, you think the world revolves around you, there are bigger things happening. You know, there's a part in which I think I want to say, yeah, you know, I'm glad he's saying that. But then the speech keeps going. And the film kind of takes, you know, saps all the power out of that when he kind of breaks down at the end. And you see that he's only concerned his own little world, right? That he says, well, he kind of cries. He says, I'm being divorced. So he goes in that moment from accusing her of only thinking about her problems to then... And apparently he's first making an appeal towards some broader idea of justice, but then he's kind of disempowered from making that speech by this sort of revelation. Maybe it's supposed to humanize him or make him sympathetic in a way, but it seems to also take the power out of what he was saying in resistance to her selfish demands.
When I originally saw that scene, that was a part of my thinking as well, even kind of level of emasculation of him when he starts, mm-hmm. kind of has his breakdown and everything, because there are other, this is at the police station, so I mean, his co-workers are around, they even stop and turn, like, what is going on? He's sobbing at his desk here, and then they kind of go back to their work. But I watched it a couple other times, and I'm very curious if we have any non-white listeners who've seen this film, if you can kind of dial in to share. After I watched it like the third time, and I said, wait a second, I can relate to this in talking to a suspected racist, and we're talking about something serious, we're talking about business, work-related matters, what have you, and they veer off into something that's totally personal, and we're supposed to like emotionally connect and be vested in their personal thing when we were talking about, you know, business-related issues that had nothing to do with their personal life. And I feel like that, I think that happens a lot where the black person is on the end where they have to get sucked into empathizing with a white person who's getting divorced or their child is sick or they got a car accident or whatever it is. That dynamic is reversed this time. It's the white person who has to sympathize with the black person about whatever their personal issue that is not connected to the business in hand. Then he even rebuffs that because she sticks her hand out to console him. He's like, get off, get off. And further, get out of my office because I am not going to help you. And he goes back to the same problem that she had at first, that you're not helping me. I'm coming here for assistance that you are not providing, and reminding her that
you didn't even lock your door to begin with, that, you know, you bear a lot of the blame to begin with for this problem. I thought it reminded me of the conversation that we had before. It reminded me of what I've said consistently about not helping white people, that is huge. And it also made me think, because it seems like I've seen more and more of these types of films. I know The Leftovers, I think that's an element there as well, where it's black people are in positions of authority where even black people can deny white people things that they need, and all the white person can do is be upset about it. I don't know. Do you get the sense, Dr. Kevorkian, that growing numbers of white people feel in some way that black people are blocking them from getting resources or causing them problems, that there are black people in powerful positions that are causing them difficulties?
I think that the results of the election show that. I think that Donald Trump tapped into that resentment. And I think in that sense, you know, one of the key words in this title is the anymore. I don't feel at home at this world anymore. Like, something has happened with the world and it's changed and it's turned on me, right? And one of the ways that it's changed is the presence of these black figures who are in a position to obstruct the progress of the white hero or heroine. Again, the episode that we talked a lot about in Black Mirror that makes me think of the Melanie Lynskey character is the nosedive episode with Bryce Dallas Howard, even like where she's making these demands at the ticket counter at the airport. Like, not a major position of power, but someone who nevertheless has power within that contest to either make, you know, the dream happen or make it. Or to prevent it from happening. So, I mean, I think our political moment shows that there are people who have had this pent-up resentment from the Obama years in particular, where there's been this symbolic presence of the non-white person in a position of authority, and it gets refracted into all of these little roles that we're seeing, that recurring pattern in these films. And I think I also want to say about this film that these scenes with the black detective are the places where that resentment comes through, kind of pops through all the other screens most clearly. I think there's kind of cover for it, where the film also wants to be about another dynamic that I think is problematic. I think that, as in Little Boxes, Melanie Lynskey is cast as an object of our pity and our sympathy. And racial politics are a backdrop for her victimization by life. And specifically, part of this kind of pity party that we're supposed to have for the Melanie Lynskey character is based upon how she suffers at secondhand the indignities of a racist society. So, for instance, in that first scene where the dying white woman says this horrible thing, it's less important that this woman has said this racist thing and that this racism exists, and it's more important to the movie that Melanie Lynskey has to put up with that. That's just another thing that is kind of a downer for her day. So there's part of the logic here is about feeling bad for white people who have to be offended by the fact that racism exists, you know, as if it's somehow bad for them, you know, compared to the actual victims of it. But that's one layer of where we're supposed to feel sympathy for the white character. I think also there are moments like this interaction with the black detective where a more direct racial resentment is expressed at black people in positions of authority. And in those moments, the characters are in alignment with the very racist that they claim to be annoyed by.
Context of white supremacy. Again, Dr. Martin Kevorkian. I think Dr. Welsing would have a lot to say about that. And she talked about that. That was why she predicted that Donald Trump would win back in 2015. She predicted more than a year in advance that he would indeed triumph in the election. I think she sensed a great deal of that white
resentment, frustration. Ruth's character, she's on depression medication and anxiety medication that's stolen from her residence, which, again, the drug use and drug use and abuse of prescription medications and all other types of drugs regularly on display in the film. I'm super, super excited to transition to Little Boxes because this is the film that started all of this. Melanie Lynskey is in this film as well, and I have ample sound clips for this one, and I hope we can get through and have time that our listeners can get in questions or two. Is there anything else that stood out from I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore?
Well, I mean, this is, I think, will set up some of the imagery that is in Little Boxes, but I did want to get back to the thing that you called up from the very beginning, which is sort of her violence against the lawn tiger, right? That, you know, there, near the end of the movie, there's this big showdown with the big bad white guy who lives in the mansion. And it's, you know, Melanie Lynskey gains no satisfaction from the interaction when she tries to confront him. And instead, she takes out her violence on these kind of black or dark wire lawn animals. Elijah Wood even says about the big bad white guy, you ought to feel sorry for him. But Melanie Lynskey decides she's going to steal or violate and be violent against these lawn animals. The woman says, not the giraffe, put the tiger down. Later we find out that it's the wife's lawn animals. But I think it's kind of strange to track the recurrence of specifically animals from Africa being used in these decorative ways. Giraffes and tigers in this one, giraffes and lions are going to come up in the next one. But, you know, I think that these figures are examples of what Toni Morrison, I'll quote her again. I always like this quotation. She refers to the always choked representation of an Africanist presence. And by Africanist, she means not a real African presence, but an imaginary Africa that whites and whiteness use to define themselves in opposition to it. But in this film, I think it's particularly when you think of the history of things that are displayed on lawns, right? And racist things that are displayed on lawns. Like, they had this big white mansion and someone told them, well, it's not politically correct, or you can't have, the lawn jockey anymore. But what has taken its place is things like these tigers or these giraffes that are still somehow an emblem of that, you know, controlling the Edgar Allan Poe raven fear, domesticating it or taming it.
Choked Africanness. That's a great line to quote the legend Toni Morrison. She's been on our book club too, The Bluest Eye. That's in my top five books. And speaking of lawn jockeys, I did mention Fargo. If you watch Fargo close, there is a flagrant long racist joke about Asian people. There are also lots of lawn jockeys, which is wacky because there is no golfing in the film. They're in Minnesota in the middle of the wintertime, but yet and still they found a way to squeeze in lots and lots of black lawn jockeys. That's in Fargo, the film that came out of Coen Brothers directly before The Big Lebowski. Transitioning to Little Boxes, which came out in 2016, also starring Melanie Lynskey and the late Nelson Ellis, who just passed away this summer. I had just mentioned this film on the program, and then weeks later he passed away at the age of 39. And I was actually watching the movie the day that I saw he passed away when I checked the news. This is, I think, out of all the films that we've discussed today, this is the film that makes it most explicit, like, yes, we are talking about racism. That's what this film is supposed to be about from the very beginning. Nelson, is this? Oh, yes, I'm supposed to give the synopsis. I can do that and then give the clip. So it came out in 2016. Black male Nelson Ellis character. He is a struggling writer. He has a book published, but now he's just writing food articles in New York. He's married to a white woman, Melanie
Linsky's character, Melanie Linsky, that's her. And they have a quote-unquote biracial son. His name is Clark. He's about 12. They say in the film he's going to the sixth grade, so he should be 11, really. But he looks a lot older than, well, he looks older than 11 to me. But he's going to the sixth grade, so he should be in the ballpark of 11. They're in New York. They're moving to Washington State, not Seattle. They're moving to Rome, Washington. There is no such place as Rome, Washington, but that's where they're moving to in the film. They get out here. It's a mostly white enclave. They're moving sight unseen because the white wife is a professor. She gets a job at the university in Rome. So this is all for her. They're moving to a house that nobody has seen but her. They get there. The house has mold. And all the child and the black husband are subjected to all of this racism as they try to adjust to being in this new spot. I think I could stop there. Did I leave anything out important from the synopsis?
Nope, that's it.
Right on. This film, huge asterisk for Gus T. Renegade, because this is one of the few times that the main racist, in my opinion, is a white child. That alone makes this a film, I would say, non-white people, you should check out. You should watch it seriously, pay attention, and take note. I can start from the very beginning with sound clips on this one. This is the kind of last conversation they have. Nelson Ellis's character, Mark Burns, he's got a black friend, he's got a white friend, all males. They're sitting around drinking his favorite tequila as they talk about why he is leaving New York.
Ma'am, New York is over if you're a real artist.
She started a hustle. It's stability, it's health insurance, it's retirement.
Okay. Plus, we just want to see what else is out there.
Racism.
That's everywhere. You racist.
We're all racist.
We're all racist. That's the very beginning. That's like in the first 3-4 minutes of the movie when they're still in New York and having some thoughts, but generally mostly excited. They're getting Packers, and this is a great career opportunity for the white woman to get out, go to Washington, and do this, and they're kind of all in together. Any thoughts on how things start out when they're off to Washington State?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's about this idea that racism is everywhere. But what happens to a certain extent is that, again, as I said with the previous film, one of the things that this movie seems to focus on is the white woman's experience of the racism that's perpetrated against her family. And the very first words of the film that are spoken, the man, Nelson Ellis, says to his wife, "Hey, baby, you good?" And a woman says, "Yeah, I'm ready." And to me, that signals from the very beginning that this is going to be about a challenge and a journey, but it's about her ordeal. To a certain extent, by the end, she gets called out on this. I mean, I think it's a film that tries to be aware of those kind of limitations. She will be someone who complains about how hard it is for her to be, I think she says, like the pale third wheel here. The Nelson Ellis character, you know, calls her out on that. You know, she's basically, he calls her out on caring only about what concerns her. Very similar to the beginning of that speech where the police officer says to Melanie Linsky and don't feel at home in Swirly Moore, you know, the world doesn't revolve around you. He calls her out on only being concerned about the things that concerns her. She says, you try and go through what we go through. You try going through that alone. There's one thing that the director said about this in an interview. The interview for the Tribeca Film Festival, where this was well received. They were interviewed, the writer and the director were interviewed by Kevin Sampson, who does a thing called the Picture Lock Show. He's a non-white person, a black film critic, and a real film scholar. part of the film interview was about talking about the technicalities of this film also not having a typical three-act structure and being interesting and non-traditional in those ways. But, you know, one of the things that Meyer, the director, says, he says, it raised the interesting question of whether Gina's character could understand what her husband and son are really going through. Being profiled, can you really know how that feels? And the answer may be no. So this is a film that I think has those limitations of being very focused on, we're supposed to feel bad for the Melanie Lynskey character, Gina, because her family experiences this racist culture that they are immersed in. But I think it's a film that tries to be aware of some of those limitations of looking at this racism from a white person's perspective. And it's not that and I'll just say the camera doesn't always track her. There are scenes where the camera is just tracking what is happening to the husband or what is happening to the son. But it does seem to be, from the beginning, framed by the concern with how she is going to experience all this indignity.
I would agree with that in terms of where the focus of the film is with her comfort. And again, they're moving sight unseen across the country, New York to Washington State, to a house for her job where, I mean, the child, you could imagine having a child who's 10 or that young going entirely across the country, leaving all their friends behind, all for white mom. Again, what I said, what really made this film stand out for me in terms of counter-racist observation, there are not many films I can think of where the racists, the people who are making clearly identifiable, unambiguously racist commentary are white children and white girls at that. That is kind of rare, but in this one, great lines. I just give two back-to-back clips. So there are these two young girls who are pretty prominent figures in the film. I'd say they take up a pretty significant chunk of screen time. Julia and Ambrosia, even that name, Ambrosia, the food of the gods, so they say, unless I've been misinformed. But these two white girls in Rome, Washington, they are the first two children that Clark meets, the quote-unquote biracial son. So he goes to Julia's house, and they hang out, listen to music, and all of that. This sound clip is the very first time that Clark goes to the residence to meet these two white girls. And again, everybody is supposed to be, I guess, around 11 or so. And then I'm going to follow that really quickly with the other clip. Both of these are short, like 20 seconds apiece. Follow that by the racist joke, or one of the racist jokes in this film, out of the mouth of babes. Ambrosia, the young white girl, she gives the racist joke. So you'll hear those two, and then we'll get Dr. Kevorkian's commentary.
Sit there. Julie and I have to talk. Oh, my God.
What?
I can't believe it.
He's cute.
We, like, totally needed a black kid.
What?
This town, it's, like, so white.
Oh, my God, we got my brother.
Figures. He is such a tool.
Welcome to the sidecar. May I take your order, please?
Don't pretend like you don't know us, Cooper.
You, ma'am?
Double nachos, please.
Am I next, Cooper?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, the world is so racist.
What?
Why did you wait to take his order last? Because he's black? Just kidding, everybody.
Love it. Racist jokes from the children. What do you make of the white children playing such a prominent role in this, or the racist white children playing such a prominent role, and that kind of being the angle that they choose with this film?
Yeah, no, it's just stunning the way that these young women pressure him, try to get him to conform to their expectation of what an Africanist presence is supposed to be, are so eager to put him on display. Like, we really needed a black kid. I mean, there's a clear difference between the two kids. Ambrosia is the one who says, you know, we really needed a black kid, whereas Julia is the one who just said, you know, that he's cute, you know, a much more neutral and welcoming assessment of him here. But Julia's the one who's kind of always directing the show, trying to control his body. The first thing she says in that clip is, you know, sit here. And she's always telling him where to sit or what to say, what to wear. Particularly doing things like she pressures him one point to take his glasses off, which I think is symbolically super important. Because there's a lot of talk in this film about you know, the acceptability of being a scholar or a nerd of some sort, and, you know, whether he's allowed to claim being scholarly or whether that's denied him in the expectation that he needs to act more black. The scene in the restaurant, I mean, it does so many flips. It's a kind of an analysis of critiquing her for trying too hard to display that she's not a racist, but then making a joke out of that. I mean, clearly she's sort of wrong. I mean, the brother is just he's going with another cultural convention, which is when you take the order, you take the lady's order first, and you take the gentleman's order next. And so he's going in that order, but she wants to sort of display her hyper-racial awareness. And then when that kind of falls flat, she just wants to make a joke of it. But it's all about how she comes off looking. And that's something that is done throughout. There's the white guy who befriends the Mac Burns character, and is so eager to show off his new black friend at the bar. Like, look at this guy. You know, I'm with this new black guy. Also, just going back to the top of the show, what Mr. Gusty Renee was saying, this through line of drugs and substances. You've got the white man offering the black man in pharmaceuticals, drugs as kind of uppers. And I actually thought it was kind of unrealistic that he convinced him to take it, but that happened. But then the parallel of that is Ambrosia also, it's this 11-year-old kid drunk. I mean, that's another sort of, maybe that's an echo of what you're saying, Gus, about Ambrosia being the food of the gods, is that she offers something that is intoxicating and it's going to have him under the influence also. So that's something that is done to both the father and the son. They're giving these drugs that alter their behavior.
I thought the neighbor was really important. Even before I get to the neighbor, the scene at the table, it reminded me a lot. I think that's another way that white people practice white supremacy racism, is that they will find ways to minimize or make it seem as though they're calling out racism when they're not really. They'll say, you know, oh, you've only got brown eggs. You don't have any white eggs. You are so racist. That sort of thing. That to me is like a more sophisticated way of practicing racism, to do these little faux call outs of racist acts just to make light of it. It's almost like it's a joke. Anytime someone accuses someone of racism or says that something is racist, this is about, you know, what the way that we should think of it, that, you know, you're just making a big to do about nothing. But I also thought with the neighbor, in comparing those two, because this 11-year-old Ambrosia, she gives Clark alcohol later on and initiates a strip tease for him. And then the neighbor, his name is Gibson, Todd Gibson. He's the neighbor of these folks at Tom Gibson, and he is the head of the Block Association, in addition to being the neighborhood pusher of uppers or pharmaceuticals, illicit drugs, whatever it is. And he's a sexual deviant. In fact, I have a sound clip of all of this with this character, Tom Gibson, because I thought I thought that this guy was important in the film for a variety of reasons. Just I'll give folks the clip so they can hear it, and then I'll give my follow-up and get Dr. Kevorkian's thoughts. This is Tom Gibson, head of the Block Association in Little Boxes.
It's actually nice to hang out with somebody other than my family.
You're telling me. Hey, I was wondering if maybe you wanted to hang out with these too.
What's that?
Around here, we call them farmies. Yeah, they're not like methy or oxy,
no.
But just stuff you get from a doctor.
No. I'm too old to be doing all that.
Oh, okay, yeah, I hear you, man. But, you know, small-town living, sometimes it could use a little boost. Cheers.
What do you do?
Oh, erotic thrillers. I.e. publish. They're very sexy, but very high class.
Erotic,
I'm writing an ass chapter right now. All about asses. You're into it.
Hey, everybody! This is my new buddy. His name is Mac. He's from New York. His wife is a professor. He is a writer. And he's going to write his new book right here in Rome.
Mike.
I'm humbled. Thank you.
The thing about this guy is, if you close your eyes, you can't even tell he's black.
You know? I mean, in a good way.
He's just very impressive.
Context of white supremacy. That was Tom Gibson talking to Nelson Ellis's character Mark Burns through. That was a couple different scenes in the film, but I thought that was important. Number one, we talked about sanitizing with Luke in the first film, The Place Beyond the Pines, and I feel like they're sanitizing right before our eyes watching this film with Tom Gibson. I don't think most people would watch this film and say, "Wow, the Burns family, they moved across the country to live next to a smut peddler." Like, he's pushing pharmaceutical drugs and selling his sexually deviant literature, and he's a racist with the comments. I don't think most people would say, "Oh yeah, that's Tom Gibson." It would just be, "Oh, that's his wacky neighbor who came over and bought him some tequila and what have you." The sanitizing. I think if you had a black character who was doing all of those things, it would not just be, "Oh, that's his, you know, wacky neighbor or what have you, who's a little annoying or what have you," where you can have a white person who's right in front of your face doing all kinds of dastardly deeds, but they're still sanitized. I mean, that just seems to be an endemic part of the system of white supremacy, where white people are just not to be held accountable for criminal behavior, racist behavior especially. But I also thought it was important in that scene, you could hear in his tone, the way he's been responding throughout. I didn't play all the scenes with this white man, Mr. Gibson, but he had quite a few. But you can hear it consistently in his tone, what we've been talking about, this irritation that, and it's not even Mark Burns' character is not somebody accomplished. He's not President Obama. I just told you he's a struggling artist who's writing food reviews. But when this white guy, when he finds out, "Oh, you've written a book? Wow, I'm just, you know, e-publishing my smut. You have an agent? Wow," like he keeps saying it like, "I can't believe it, like this nigger's doing better than I am, like, wow, he's a more accomplished writer than I am." I felt that sense of irritation along with the racism, white supremacy in his presentation. Is that, what do you think of that, Dr. Kevorkian?
No, I think that's absolutely key, that there's this resentment to the writer's success, and yet even in the moment when he resents the man's superior accomplishment, he's still kind of presuming that he's going to be able to tell him about, you know, useful things like, you know, we'll talk about the craft. We'll talk about, you know, inspiration versus perspiration. Like, suddenly he's going to try to not only, he's resentful of him, but he's also going to try to raise himself to his level where they could, you know, share advice as peers. He's going to kind of try to draft off of that success and get a part of it and be attached to it vicariously. He's continually wanting to bask in this guy's glory, even as he resents him for it. And I mean, there's a lot of quick transitions. Like, you know, when he introduces in the bar, he moves from sort of his most stereotyping statement about him, like this assumption that this guy would somehow, that Mac would somehow be into this smut that he's writing. He just assumes it as a fact. And then very next thing, he's saying, yeah, but he doesn't sound black, at the same time that he's sort of asserting some stereotypical blackness about him. The thing I would say, and this is something a listener brought up last time when I was criticizing that Bryce Dallas Howard episode, the nosedive, a woman who called in, she said, well, you know, isn't it possible that this episode is trying to critique some of these dynamics of trying to critique the expectations that Bryce Dallas Howard character was making all these demands to be helped? And there's part of me that wants to be open to that possibility, that this is a film that very seriously wants to dissect and analyze the mentality of someone like a Tom Gibson, and wants to pick apart all the various pieces of how his racism operates. Just as I think it pretty brilliantly exposes the way that the racism operates for Ambrosia, as Mr. Renegade just analyzed it in the joking scene, you know, pretending to be calling out racism, but then making it a joke. I think that's a valuable kind of analysis that the film, I would say, helps make available. So I agree that there's a sanitization and there's a minimization. There's very different. I mean, you just put this again next to Big Lebowski, compare the Tom Gibson character portrayal to the really over-the-top portrayal of the child molester in the John Turturro character in Lebowski. Completely different kinds of portrayals. That said, even if it's not as obvious, I think there's a possibility that this film is making an effort to get us to think critically about the Tom Gibsons of the world.
Hopefully, and the Melanie Linskys and Ambrosias as well, as a white collective.
Yeah.
What did you make of the scene, especially since you're down there in Austin, Texas? I think UT Austin is commonly thought of as being a bastion of academic liberalism. What did you make of the scene at this fictitious college where Melanie Linsky's character, she's a professor at? This scene, I guess it's part of some sort of staff get together that they have soon after she moves to Washington. It's made her initial introduction to the staff and what have you. This is a quick get together, about 15 seconds.
Hail to thee from college.
Missionaries, missionaries, we're on top.
Missionaries, missionaries, we're on top. What did you make of that scene? And did that ring authentic to your UT of Austin experience?
No, it did not. Although, I will say that there's, you know, lots of strange things that are, you know, legacies of fight songs. And, you know, we've got a fight song here. Is, you know, the eyes of Texas are upon you. You cannot get away. I mean, there's something kind of creepy about that. But I thought this was kind of an over-the-top, jokey thing that sort of didn't ring true. On the other hand, I think it's based on the writer's personal experience. I mean, you know, we've noticed that Rome, Washington is not a real place, right? But the woman who wrote this film moved to Athens, Ohio for an academic position. So it's like Athens becomes Rome. So it's, again, sort of these places in America that have called themselves after these foundational, you know, pillars of civilization or of empire. But yeah, I think there's a kind of jokiness about the way academia is portrayed here that is maybe deliberately over the top and farcical. That, you know, the idea that tenure is, you know, a license to imbibe, and, you know, that they just go out and get drunk and do whatever they want. It's not true to my experience. So
when I watched this with a group of people and we watched that scene,
And they said immediately, that is the religion of white supremacy. Missionaries, we are on top. And the religion of white supremacy always mandates sexual exploitation. And I thought they were being very tongue-in-cheek with that line, missionaries, we are on top, in a film that is centered on, quote-unquote, interracial relationships, where, in my view, the white woman is indeed on top. Melanie Lynskey's character, she is the one whose priorities take concern over everybody. That's why they moved halfway across the country. She's in the room with them when they're doing this chant. She's the only one of the main three characters that's present for that scene, missionaries, we are on top. The scenes at the end are extraordinary. I want to pause in case folks have listeners. I'll get in one more sound clip and then see if folks have questions. So many times in this film, Melanie Lynskey's portrayal reminds me of her performance in I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. I think someone who saw both of these films said, oh man, I didn't even recognize her. And I was stunned because I was like, she looks exactly the same. She sounds exactly the same. Like some of the lines, some of her expressions are very, very similar. I think in terms of how you are supposed to empathize with her. And then she transfers that empathy to another white woman. I thought there was a great scene towards the end of the movie where her son, after lots of things have happened in terms of everybody having a very difficult time adjusting and being in this moldy house thousands of miles from their former home and the racist children and racist neighbors and just everything that they're dealing with in this massive transition, they get to the end. Clark has gotten in trouble. He's had a conflict with the young racist child, Ambrosia. She's upset with him because she finds out he has a white mom, and so he's not authentically black enough for her, so she doesn't want to talk to him anymore, so he's upset. All these things have happened. Clark lashes out at her and throws a rock at Ambrosia's house, and so Ambrosia's white mother comes to confront Clark's parents, and this is their second confrontation. Ambrosia, we already talked about, Ambrosia gave alcohol to Clark while they were together, and so after they have their alcoholic beverages, she does a striptease, and Ambrosia's white mother walks in on this, and of course, Clark, rapist again, back to John Turturro, you gotta watch those black people and their genitals, but the mom walks in and gets upset, and so that causes a big to-do, so that's already happened. So by the time we get to this scene where Clark has gone, thrown this rock and broke a window, the mom comes to confront again Clark's parents about his behavior, and this is what we hear.
Just look at me, okay? You can tell us. Did you do this?
No.
I saw him!
You saw him? Wasn't it dark? Or is it just easy to imagine that he did it?
Okay, I think, Clark, I think you should wait upstairs. Just...
Mr. Burns, I think you find me to be ignorant. I think you find me to be a racist.
I didn't say that, Joan.
You think I assume your son is delinquent because he's African-American?
Yes.
I found him practically naked with my daughter, and now he destroyed my property. I think that's a good reason to call the police, which I plan to do.
Are you crazy? Is something wrong with you? He's an 11-year-old child. You want to call the police on him? For what?
Okay.
Are you trying to ruin my son's life?
Okay, I think we should just stop. Just stop. Should we have some coffee? Can you come in?
No, I will not come in.
No, let her go.
You know, I have credit towards a master's degree, and I've raised two children by myself.
We did not mean...
Just stop!
Context of white supremacy. I've talked about weeping white women before. Man, I think it is important in what the scene that you just heard when she says, I saw your son, he was practically naked with my daughter. It was, in fact, her white daughter who was disrobing, and it was her idea. She was the one that conceived this plan to begin with, to have some sort of striptease after she had served alcohol for herself and Clark, the young 11-year-old, quote-unquote, biracial male. But it was her daughter who was the one who was stripping, not Clark. This scene, Melanie Lynskey's character, she comes in to stick up for this aggrieved white mom and saying, you know, you can't malign her and have her in tears. She really kind of takes Nelson Ellis's character to task. What were your thoughts with this scene and how the fallout from it, Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was remarkable that, in a sense, the mother is allowed to make this leap from, you know, I saw him throw the rock, is her claim, when, as far as I can tell from the way it's shot, it would be impossible for her. He's gone by the time she comes out and steps on the glass. I don't know if that's, maybe we're supposed to imagine that she sees something that we don't see her seeing, but it seemed very clear that she couldn't possibly have seen him. But in her mind, it's enough that he saw her, she saw him together with her daughter. That's what she saw, and that's enough for her to accuse him of whatever. It's a sort of almost logic of Lynch law, that if there's been some even accusation of inappropriate looking, then any sort of accusation of illegality is going to stick. And it's kind of great the way Mac sticks up for his kid. You know, he says he doesn't want this woman to ruin his life by calling the cops. And that seems like that is both admirable and I think even effective at that point. But then it is very strange that, you know, Gina, the character, says to him afterwards, you know, very, again, using words of commands, she says things like, you can't do that. You have to engage. You have to try. Telling him what he can't do, telling him what he has to do. So it's her desire to control this situation and try to salvage some sort of relationship where she could still have coffee with this woman in some possible future world. And then, I mean, sort of the strange thing is that at some level, like the big turn that kind of leads to the resolution of the film is where the kid says, well, I broke the window. So even though the profiler mom was wrong, at some level she is right and the dad is wrong. You know, he's defending the kid, but and he's right to defend him against legal action, but it shows him to have been, in this instance, in some literal sense, wrong about what happened in this scene. Even if the woman was not justified in her accusation, nevertheless, in some level, she gets to be right and he has to be wrong. Which I thought was very strange way to conclude it.
I've seen that pattern consistent. They have so many films on racism. Spinning Into Butter comes to mind, where a black student makes an allegation that students have been attacking him racially. He's been subjected to all this racial animosity over weeks, and it turns out that he was doing it himself, and some of the white people had been saying that that's what they thought it was, so it turns out that they were right all along. And there are a few others that I can think of where you have that sort of, even Crash comes to mind, the scene at the very end of the film when Lorenz Tate, he has a chest, or it's a sink piece, something non-lethal that he has in his pocket that he's laughing about. He goes in his pocket to pull it out. The white guy who's giving him a ride, he thinks it's a gun, so he shoots him. But the audience knows he did have a gun. So he was right. He could have been pulling a gun out of his pocket to check him. If he had checked him, he would have found the gun and, hey, all good. It would have been a legal shoot. I have seen that a lot, particularly in films where there's some, even a hint that someone might be accused of racism or practicing racism. And they flip it back on you that the black, they do it twice in Crash, that they're trying to say that a black police officer was a victim of racism. Then it turns out that he was selling drugs and he had like a kilo of heroin in his car and all this other stuff. Like, it's pretty common. I've seen that in films where they flip it around where the black person, it turns out, is guilty, even though racism may have been practiced by somebody. My last comment, I guess I will get in. I think it's very important in this film, even if they had egalitarian means when they started, and I never lead with that assumption if it's a white person involved with a project. This film, as you said, like, things seem to be resolved once he admits guilt. Like, I find it typical, tacky, that in a racist film, things would conclude and seem right with the world where this quote-unquote biracial child is laboring in the yard for this white woman. would have to be racist if her daughter is saying all these things. Where did she get this from at 11 years old, if not the white mom and whoever else is in the family? But now things are right with the world. White mom is chilling and doing her job. Nelson Ellis's character is cooking. We don't see any advancement in his career. He's not writing. He's not at the typewriter. He's happily cooking in the kitchen. And Clark is working and doing yard work for this. And they don't even show any sort of reconciliation between Clark and Ambrosia, the children. They do show it with Julie, kind of, but, and he doesn't even get in her house. Like, they reconcile and she leaves him on the porch. She closes the door in his face twice. But with Ambrosia, there's no reconciliation, and you are just the help, literally. You are here to do field work for us and to work off, you know, your violation of our property, breaking the window. Anything you wanted to get in on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a moment where they almost try to want to make it better, where the woman says, oh, the brother will help him bag. You know, so the brother, the guy that was the waiter in the previous scenario, it's kind of like showing he's going to be a good guy, he's going to help him out. But if you think about that, that really reveals that, I mean, they've got a kid there who could be mowing the lawn for them. It's this sort of this ostentatious display that they're requiring that this kid come and do it. And just a tiniest of gestures, like, well, the brother will help you bag after you've done all the work and get some credit for that. So just a little detail, but caught my ear.
Indeed. Folks who dialed in, if you have a question, I know it takes a while to get through some of the films because there's so many details, and particularly with the Big Lebowski and little boxes, I, you know, could say quite a bit. If you have a question, something stood out with the films, feel free, 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943-#. Press *6 if you have a question. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian? Anything stand out you wanted to comment on?
Gus, can you come right back to me? I'm about to punch you.
Oh, absolutely. We'll give you 5 minutes or so. The person who called in 2617, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Yes, I do.
Proceed.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Hello.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Kevorkian, how are you perceived by your white colleagues after they find out about your work helping us understand the system of white supremacy, racism in theater or in movies? Have you had any direct threats, or have anybody cut you off, or, you know?
Not that I know of, sir. Not that I know of, sir. I mean, as Mr. Renegade has alluded to, you know, I'm lucky in where I have landed. It's sort of a bastion of people that would tend to be supportive of this kind of work. So my colleagues would be and are supportive of this kind of research. So, you know, I know y'all who listen out there, they're out in parts of the world where this kind of thinking is not embraced. So I realize that I'm lucky to be in that position, but I haven't been cut off or threatened.
Okay. Is that, do you think it would change directly if any of your, what you would call personal friends heard you on the show?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I would say that there have been friends that have Googled me and, you know, have asked me questions about it. And, you know, like I've said before, you know, it's the title of the show says a lot, context of white supremacy. And if you, you know, want to talk about white supremacy, you have to spend some time, you know, establishing the context. So, yeah, I would say I've had some explaining to do in terms of, you know, what this is about, but not a lot. Not a lot of people have raised that question.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Yes, sir.
For sure. Thomas in New York, I'm going to give you a little bit more time because that was not quite 5 minutes. So hang tight and I'll come right back. Roz, did you have commentary for Dr. Kevorkian? You should be with us.
Yes. Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to you, Dr. Kevorkian. It's good to have you back on the program with us. I had one question and then one comment. the comment, I believe it was the third film, because I actually didn't see any of these movies, but I was listening quite closely. But in the third film, you had made a comment where you were discussing, you said that there was a, one of the white men in the film said that he did not want to turn into a machine. And that stood out to me because it took me back to Color Monitors. When you look up the etymology of the word robot, robot means to be a slave. So not being a machine is a coded pseudonym for not being black, because now black today, to be black, the connotation with slavery is immediate and automatic. So to me, it was just like a coded way of them saying that they didn't want to be black or be a slave, in referencing not wanting to be a machine. That was just an observation from what you had said. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about was the homoeroticism in The Big Lebowski. I just wanted to ask you, do you think that homoeroticism and homosexuality plays such a prominent role in white culture because it is used as a tool of dominance? And the reason, the context in which I'm looking at it, is when you look at dogs, dogs can use homosexual or homoeroticism as a means of dominance over other dogs. Chimps do the same thing. They focus on the genitals in the form of actually tearing the genitals off of another male rival chimp after killing them. They'll tear their genitals off and throw them. And then the only other animal besides those two that focus on the genitals are also male lions, who are sometimes known to use their claws to tear the genitals of another male who they catch sleeping with one of their females. And in human culture, the only human that practices this sort of terroristic focus on the genitals are white males. So I wanted to know if you think, because that's one of my theories in addition to Dr. Welsing, is that because it's a tool of dominance, that that is why it's so all-pervasive and highly embraced in white culture. And I wanted to know if you kind of felt the same way. Thanks again, and I'll mute my line.
Thank you very much, Roz. I want to thank you for both the comment and the question. Yeah, obviously, I think you're right on the mark with your comment about the fear of turning into a machine as being linked to the fear of being identified as a robot, which is code for being a slave. Again, just to clarify, that was playing on the soundtrack. The song was about the man that was a man in me, so it wasn't a character in the film, but it was superimposed over a non-white character who was doing a repetitive task and kind of acting robotic. So I think it works perfectly. I would also just thank you for your question, because your question really helps clarify for me what the presence of that homoeroticism was doing in the Big Lebowski and as a factor in culture. You know, looking back on my remarks, you know, the guy, the stranger in the Big Lebowski complains about rambling. I'm always rambling, but I really felt like I feel like I don't have a grip on being able to account for what that homoeroticism is doing. But the idea that it is used as a role of dominance, you know, is consistent with, you know, another thing that I didn't perceive, you know, that Mr. Gusty Renegade was pointing out the song, you know, Missionaries, Missionaries, We're on Top. That's another way of thinking of sex and superiority at the same time. And thinking about the clip that the clip, the super clip that Mr. Gusty Renegade put together, when you think about the specific kinds of homosexual activity that are described there, it is all about kind of dominance, putting someone in a lower position. You know, the thing that John Goodman is saying over and over again as he is beating the car, beating the Corvette, you know, do you see what happens basically when you violate someone? And he in himself in that moment is trying to claim that power of, you know, symbolically leading the car, as he's talking about when you try to violate someone in a way that is about subjugation. So it's different than other kinds of homoeroticism. It's almost not erotic. Erotic is maybe almost the wrong word. More about power than it is about pleasure. All I can say is, no, I did not think that, but I think it now, Roz. I think that question helps me understand a question that I had when Gus brought up it, that it's undeniable that this theme is pervasive in this film, but that makes a lot of sense as to what it is about. So, thank you.
Appreciate that, Roz. Let's see. Oh, I can go back now. It has been five. Thomas in New York, did you have a question now?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, actually, I have three questions. Hopefully, they're appropriate. My first question, and I'm only asking this because, you know, I don't get to speak to white people very often about racism. And you seem to be pretty forthcoming. So my question to you, and I just want to know what you think on this. If in the event of a great calamity like we've seen these hurricanes, and per se a white woman has a black family, husband and child, do you think there would be, if there was an evacuation and there was a line for white people only, and a line for other people, do you think there'll be any white women that would leave with the white-only line and leave their family behind?
Huh. Wow. Wow. Well, you know, I mean, it's... sorry, say if there was, like, a relief line, there would be a white-only line. Do you think that they would, that that would be enough to sort of sever the loyalty of...
No, an evacuation line. You know, whites are going one place. You know, you got to get on this line. Non-whites might be going somewhere else.
Huh. Yeah. I don't know. I guess if I understand the question correctly, the optimist would say I would like to think in that instance, no, that you know, the victims would not, of disasters would stay with their families, that would not, you know, take advantage of that kind of a divisive policy. But I don't know. I don't know. I mean, people will sadly do most anything. Yeah.
I was hoping to get a yes or no, but that was a very good question. Earlier in the show, you mentioned, you used the phrase yourself, both white nationalism, and then in another clip you mentioned black nationalism. Now, I ask this because the conversation with you and Gus had to pertain to Eva Mendes. First, is in your opinion, just looking at her, is she a white woman to you?
My first thought is no, but it's an imperfect experiment. I know you're looking for a yes or no. To me, looking at her, the answer is no, but it's probably, I have to also say the answer is probably no, primarily because I know what her name is, right? So I'm seeing with what I know about her name, like maybe if someone did some sort of test, I might respond differently if I had faces without, you know, ability to look and say, oh, I can identify that's that kind of a name. It's hard for me to separate out the way I process that. So,
okay. And well, he also mentioned Carnello. Off of first sight, would Carnello be white, or would you have to also associate a name with him as well? Just off of first sight,
that?
You don't know what he on the boxer. I think
Carnello. No, I'm sorry. I'm not familiar. Mr. Renegade mentioned this. Was it, you said it was a Triple G coming up or something like that, but...
Oh, okay, you're not familiar with that.
But, I mean, Carmelo itself is an interesting name. It's kind of a ambiguous color, right? You know, I'm not familiar with the boxer, I'm sorry. Man, I've just got disappointing answers here, but, yeah.
Oh, okay. So my question in that really was... do you think that American nationalism, American patriotism, which is usually promoted through Hollywood and promoted to the masses, do you think that really exists in the system of racism, white supremacy?
Yeah, I mean, Dana Nelson wrote a book called National Manhood. and came out a while ago. It actually came out in 1988, sometimes The Big Lebowski. National Manhood, Capitalist Citizenship, and the Imagined Fraternity of White Men. And she traces in this book, you know, going back really to the American Revolution, this kind of imagined brotherhood of white men that defined the nation for them. And I think, you know, the implication of this study is that, you know, we've inherited institutions and traditions that come out of those, you know, the acts of the founding fathers.
I asked that question because, you know, I hate to go back on boxing. Earlier they said you didn't watch. But when I watched the fight between McCullough and Floyd Mayweather, all of the white Americans had Irish flags. So I wanted to know, I mean, because that's definitely not nationalism. So I was just curious as to if you thought, because I don't see those things existing in a system of racism and white supremacy. No patriotism to the country, patriotism to your race. But I think that kind of proved it. But my very last question for you, and this is totally unrelated because all of the movies you guys went over, I never saw. But the show is a television show called Power. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, if you've seen it.
Oh, I'm sorry. What's the show?
It's called Power.
Power?
Yes. If you're not familiar with it, it's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know that.
Well,
but what do you see the nature of Power in that show as being?
Well, it's a show produced or funded by the rapper 50 Cent, and it's a black drug dealer who has a white best friend who's all his partner in crime and drug dealing. And the black guy's trying to go legit, and the white guy is kind of stuck into the game and trying to drag the black guy back in. But it's a lot of racial things I see in that show. So I wanted to know your thoughts on it, but you haven't seen it. So I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas in New York. Again, I'm sorry to give the wishy-washy academic answers. I do try to be forthright. I do try to answer the best I can about these. I wondered, you know, you just mentioned 50 Cent. I wondered if, sort of sideways, that Little Boxes was taking a jab at that kind of name with the rapper that the young man, you know, ends up with the poster in his room is a rapper who calls herself 2-Bit. So again, sort of like this rapper taking a name based on monetary nickname. So I wondered if there's certain kind of disapproval that's voiced in this film. What was else I was going to say? Oh, you talked about the different kinds of nationalisms, and there being even like the idea of an Irish nationalism. I think you mentioned McCullers was the name, and there's a sort of pride, Irish pride, and that is its own sort of thing. I wonder if The Big Lebowski kind of separates that out too, because you've got the dude, you know, and Donnie and Walter, who are all read as white, and they are one team, one bowling team, and they're the bowling team that's, identified with these are the rules. And we've already mentioned that the nemesis is the John Turturro character, the Jesus character, the Hispanic character, but his partner is O'Brien. So it's a kind of a, if you look historically, there's a very curious book. It's called How the Irish Became White. And it's the idea that, you know, back in the 19th century, when the first waves of Irish immigrants came around, they were not considered to be white. They were considered to be non-white, and did a lot of things to sort of gain and earn white status, including, participating in a racist culture that subjugates black people. But I think it's also interesting to see even the vestiges of that you've got this white bowling team, and then still the antagonists are the Hispanic guy and the Irish guy, maybe, who's has a kind of ethnicity that might be outside of that standard white national manhood. that might have an allegiance to something other than the American nature that, you know, Walter is always repeating that his buddies but died face down in the mud defending it.
Walter complains about the Kraut who made the bowling schedule later on in The Big Lebowski as well, continuing that. Noel Ignatieff has been a guest on this program, author of How the Irish Became White. The caller 4243. Did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian, 4243?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is Rick from Ohio. Just two questions in there, both about little boxes. The first thing, I actually thought that the character Tom Gibson, I thought that he was more accomplished than Mack Burns, just simply because, you know, he said he was a publisher, even though it was like basically like a pornography publisher. But like in that brief scene where he asks Mack, well, do you need help with something or something along those lines when Mack is just walking down the street, it seemed like he had a very, you know, big house. So I assume that, you know, his books weren't, you know, all that, you know, terrible. So the first question I have is, would you say that, Dr. Kevorkian, would you say that just the kind of relationship or somewhat friendship that Tom and Mack develop is possibly another way of white people, or example of how white people with black friends practice like a subtle type of racism? Because it seems like if Mack, from just my understanding, and I could be wrong, if Mack, let's say if he is an accomplished publisher and Tom is an accomplished publisher and Mack is someone who's kind of like almost seen as like a struggling writer because he only has put out one book. It seems like whites, they do practice nepotism, but that was not something that he offered Mack as far as trying to help him, you know, with his publishing. I don't know if you wanted to answer that one first, or if you wanted to hear the second question.
No, I'll take a stab at that. I mean, that's a fascinating theory. I mean, I guess my guess had been that I think it's fair. It's correct to say that Tom is certainly accomplished in the world. I mean, he seems to be wealthy and successful. I wasn't sure if that came from having a publishing empire or if that, I almost got the sense that he's like some successful businessman. And then he presumes that he can dabble in writing on the side and still presume to be as, you know, have something to offer to this person who does that full time. Like one of the things that the Mack character is always running up against is people don't ever seem to believe that he's really working, but you know, he doesn't have that 9-to-5 job, but he's always working on his book, working on his writing. But yeah, if that's actually the fact that he is, if you consider the fact that he is economically successful as a publisher and that he could be in a position to materially help Mack, then there's even sort of more bite to his offer, this offer of weak advice, as opposed to actually offering him material help, not offering him the nepotism that he would give to a member of the white Brotherhood. I would not have considered to see it that way, but I mean, I think that's a way that you could read a failure to offer real help there.
All right. Thank you. And then the last thing, I know that towards the end of the movie, like y'all were speaking about when they kind of briefly was hinting at classism, but it seems like Ambrosia, which is, I guess, the daughter of the lower class, quote unquote, white woman who in the sound clip, she said, oh, well, I've raised two kids on my own and I have credits towards a master's degree. It seems like Ambrosia being the more, meaning the kind of like the poorer one, and Julia being the one in kind of like this sprawling mansion, it seems like Ambrosia is the one who actually is more in charge. So doesn't that kind of like go against the whole hegemonic theory that, you know, the more the wealthier whites are the ones who are more so in charge and the poorer ones just kind of go along with it just so they can maintain their whiteness?
Yeah. I think that would complicate that. It's I hadn't even stopped to think of that detail. I mean, somehow I was thinking of that as being Ambrosia's house precisely because she is so in charge. I mean, now that you think of it, no, it's Julia's house. It's not the house that he goes and throws rocks at. I mean, I think of Ambrosia going in there and mixing drinks for people. Yeah, she's taking charge there. So I'm trying to think is there a way, though, that this is still accounted for by a version of a hegemonic theory? I don't know. I feel like, she is in a position of power, but, I mean, there is a way in which wealthy white people can deploy resentful, poorer white people to still accomplish their hegemonic goals. And maybe one of those roles could involve the appearance of being in power.
All right. I'm sorry. I just didn't want to take up too much more time. I actually only have one other thing. I just wanted to get your thoughts on one scene also in the same movie. It was a scene between Clark and Mac. It was right after Ambrosia found out that Clark's mom was white, and she was really mad about that. And then they had the discussion about Maxine telling Clark not to generalize people, not to put people in groups. And then Clark's retort was, that's not the way it actually is. And I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that. And that's the last question/comment I have. Thank you.
Oh, we got that sound clip. If people want to hear exactly the way that scene went down, we got that quick 40 seconds.
I don't like white people.
There are good white people.
Maybe in New York.
Your mother.
Not here.
That's a generalization.
People generalize about me.
It doesn't matter, Clarky. You can't treat people like they're groups. You have to treat people like they're individuals. We've talked about this.
I know we talked about this over and over.
And we're going to talk about it over and over and over again.
That's not the way it actually works.
I allowed the music to play because he had no retort, just to make sure that folks could see I didn't cut it out. He had no retort to that. Proceed, Dr. Kevorkian.
No, I want to see, was that Rhett from Ohio who called our attention to this? Or?
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure I got the name right.
Yes, sir.
But yes, I mean, I think that it's what you clipped and what you highlighted there has power to it. The kid has the first word and the kid has the last word. I will say that when the filmmakers talk about this film, they talk about one of the things that they hope is a takeaway of the idea of treating people like individuals. And in interpersonal interactions, I think that's a great ethic. But I think the kid is also right that this is a film that shows that, you know, he is experiencing realities that are based on the fact that people treat people as groups, and he has to contend with that. So, yes, there's an ethic of treating the people you meet as individuals, but there's also analysis to be done on the level of what is happening, what has been historically happening, and what continues to happen of people being treated as groups. And it's to the film's credit to let that last statement by the kid stand, even if it thinks it's saying the other thing ultimately.
Appreciate that, Dr. Kevorkian. And Red, one thing I would add, that's a pattern that I've noted over years in conversations on racism, white supremacy, where non-white people, black people, are lumped collectively. That's how you are processed, seen, treated. And consistently, it's white people that I hear that are saying, I do not want to be treated as a collective, part of the white collective, white racist collective. I just want to be seen as an individual apart from that. I have seen that consistently within my time discussing racism,
white supremacy when, as a white individual, there is absolutely no way possible you can be apart from the white collective. I'm just making a flat statement. I could be in error. The person that called in, last four digits, 2812. 2812, did you have a question for Dr. Kevorkian?
Yeah, good evening, Gus. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Dr. Kevorkian. I've seen two of the films. One is fresh on my mind. I can't remember the name of it. It's a little late. I'm on the East Coast. But the film with Marshall Ali, that I watched that one yesterday. Yeah, appreciate that, Gus. I watched it yesterday evening, and with Gus's advice to be prepared for the call. And one of the things I immediately noticed was it seems like the directors were trying to posture his behavior as being, you know, a quiet, upstanding individual, but literally he comes off as pathetic. Because in all of the scenes that he gets confrontation, he does not react, in my opinion, appropriately. Whether it's the scene where he's first greeted with the racist, and even just his comments are extremely suspect. Coming home, going upstairs, seeing this gentleman upstairs. Yeah, it's his kid, but this guy doesn't pay any rent or a mortgage in a property. And he's consistently just conversating with him, knowing that there's going to be a confrontation. And I think with the directors, in my opinion, they were just trying to show the power of white supremacy to say this white guy can walk in your house, doesn't even have to belong in this house. It doesn't matter if it's your kid. I'm going to harm you either way. And then the next scene, which I thought was even more prevalent, is when the police came to the door and they're talking to Eva Mendez, and he just says, let him go ahead through. No fight, no push. And I just thought it was really interesting because it was just a clear illustration that that's the system of racism, white supremacy. You're a black male. You just let them do what they do. Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
I think that's I think that is an accurate assessment, sir. Yeah, and I'd overlooked that scene with the cops coming to the door, but you're right. I think that the film does play it both ways. Of one hand, presenting him as this upstanding member of the community, by the other hand, continually showing him as powerless, and as I think your word for it is kind of pathetic. I mean, I think there's also in that scene with the cops, there's a kind of world weary realism that, you know, that maybe he doesn't expect justice from that avenue. But yeah. That's another scene that we could put right up against the other ones having to do with the home invasion by the Ryan Gosling character, that show, you know, how this white character can act with impunity in this man's house in a way that's really offensive.
Sir Gus, can I ask another question, please?
Proceed.
Little Boxes, I saw that a couple of months ago, for listeners as well. Google a picture of Ms. Howell. You'll see a lot of similarities to the film itself. One thing that I noticed, and I wanted to get Dr. Kevorkian's take, was the way that the little girls were treating their son was almost as I'd like to call an animal in a cage when they first approach him. Or even talk to him, the way they look at him, the way they view him, even the way that they're dancing for him, it's almost as if I wonder how he's going to react. And even though I think maybe the directors are trying, particularly Ms. Howell, because, you know, they're in what we call a tragic arrangement, particularly her, what she was trying to come off in the film for maybe giving them a sense of humanity. When I watched the film, and this is just my opinion, it was almost as if this is what you can produce when you have these relationships, a non-melanated child that young white women will clamor after because he has little curly hair. Like, I watched the film 3 or 4 months ago, and that's literally what came off, is that he's just some sort of hybrid animal that you can examine, but he's still not a human being. And I just wanted to know if that would be an accurate assessment or what's your take on how the relationship and specifically how the young man is portrayed in the film?
Yeah, I think he's immediately exoticized. I did mention that, you know, they try to control his body and tell him where to sit, what to do. But you're right. They immediately, one of the first things they want to do, they want to take pictures of him, right? I mean, I guess that's take pictures of a lot of people and a lot of things. But there's a way in which they've encountered this exotic creature and they want to capture that on film and themselves as being participants in there. As I said before, there are images of lions everywhere, they get him to ultimately kind of perform. They get him to roar like an animal, roar like a lion. Something that, you know, gets him in trouble on one level, but is on the other hand exactly what is expected of him.
Sure. And then my last question. Oh, I'm sorry. Last one quick one. Dr. Kevorkian, have you seen a film called Extortion? It's got the character from, what's that tacky Tom Cruise movie with the Somalian pirates? Have you seen that film?
No. Extortion.
Yeah. Check that one out. It's even worse than those two. I'll be my line, guys. Thanks a lot.
All right. Extortion and Power are now on my list from these. And I want to thank the last caller for hanging in there on the East Coast. And I've got to find a way to be less long-winded when I give my answers. So sorry to keep you up so late, sir.
Mr. Nero dialed in. Long-time listener. I think he's got a few questions in for Dr. Kevorkian over the years. Mr. Nero, did you have a question?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Greetings. I'm calling, I think, from the internet, so I may have some issues, but I didn't hear the majority of the show, nor have I watched the movies that you mentioned, but I had an idea or a thought, I should say, that kind of shook me, and I reached for your book and just kind of started going through it. So let me just ask you a question. It doesn't have anything to do with the movies, but it has more to do with your book and your work. By putting, black face on technology, do you think it's possible that as technology continues to increase, that black people will be targeted more and more for hostility and combative from black people as well as non-black people and whites as well, as they begin to lose more and more jobs due to the technological increases?
Yeah, I think that is a real concern. If in America the black man is the original robot, what if you get, to a point where you have purely technological robots to do that same work? That's something that might be seen as disproportionately affecting people who have done that kind of work. So I will say there are studies, implementations of robotics that are showing that sometimes it doesn't result in the loss of employment that had previously been foretold as something that was going to be, a world without work and a world without jobs. I think it's something that we may have talked about this a little bit in the movie iRobot. Where Will Smith is walking down the street and he's given hard looks to all the robots that he sees. And like he sees them, but he's giving hard looks to robots that he sees doing kind of menial tasks, like a robot that's walking, a dog walker, or a robot that's collecting trash. And they sort of resenting the fact that the robots have taken these jobs. And I wondered if there was a dimension to that, in this movie, those robots are foreseen as taking labor that's performed by non-whites disproportionately. In terms of what's really happening with robotics, I'm not sure that that's going to be the way it's going to play out. But there's a logic to that in American racism and I think it really is something that Gus said when we introduced me to the last show of seeing seeing the black body as the original technology. What if that then can be replaced? That is something that is worth a thought. Mr. Nero, you didn't see these films, but you wouldn't have seen anything that would surprise you. I think last time you asked, about how rare it is that you see examples of a black man together with a black woman. And if I'm not mistaken, you didn't see it in any of these films either. So.
Well, I have seen The Big Lebowski a long time ago. I'd have to go back and rewatch it because it was so long ago when I saw that film. One of the callers mentioned the television show Power. And I think one of the things, as soon as he mentioned Power, that came to mind is that there's a lot of texting in the television show, especially with the main character. At least that's what it seems to me to be. A lot of, texting, him either texting his wife or his wife partner or his love interest. I mean, there's just a lot of texting I noticed between, the main character and different people on the show. And the reason why I bring this up, not so much because of the robots, but because of just to take a segment of technology that people probably don't really associate with losing their jobs, but computer networking has killed a lot of jobs because that allowed companies to centralize their sales and get rid of sales departments all throughout the country. I mean, just if I just take just one company in particular, that one company would be CompUSA. CompUSA used to have stores all over the country. And how they got rid of a lot of those jobs was they just centralized their sales division in Dallas. And because of, networking, they were able to do it, through computer networking. They were able to, bring everybody in one spot and then allow people to go to the website to order their products and then just keep maybe just one particular person at those retail locations, and they got rid of everyone else. So I'm not just looking at it from the standpoint of robots, but just overall technology, overall really replacing a lot of jobs. And I really don't think people are really, cognizant of that at all. Just that one segment alone, networking alone, has killed a lot of jobs, but no one sees it that way. At least I don't speak to people that see it that way.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think that we've already seen huge impact from that. Yeah, that has happened and it's continuing to happen. So I think you're probably right that what I'm talking about with robots per se is not the whole picture by any means, and that the destructive effects on jobs has already happened. I mean, the sort of the sick thing that happens with the statistics is that, they keep saying that, productivity of the American worker is going up. But that's, productivity is augmented by technology means, that one person can be more productive, but that means then you don't have to hire as many people. So it looks like productivity is going up, but that doesn't mean that people earning a living are seeing the benefits of that, increased productivity. Quite the contrary. But I'm not an economist. I really am not. But that's a serious thing to consider, sir.
Exactly. Okay. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Mr. Nero. I think we nabbed all the folks who had a hand up. I had two final quick questions I wanted to get in. These are both from little boxes that I wanted to ask before we let you enjoy the rest of your Monday evening. Nelson Ellis, I said he passed away this summer at the age of 39. Heart complications. Mm-hmm. I did not know he had any illnesses. I think more people are familiar with him from True Blood, HBO's long-running series. It ended recently a few years back, but it was on for a long, long time, and he was a big part of that show. I looked at his death at 39, and I look at Little Boxes, a film where this black male, struggling with his job, moved across the country, married to a white woman, gets moved across the country in a house he's not seen that's infested with mold. He suffers racist attacks from neighbors, his wife's colleagues, who assume his vocabulary is so stunted that he as a writer does not know what the word marked means. Just constant abuse in all these different shapes and forms, his child being abused and what have you, all of these stresses that he faces. And then I looked, real life character dies at 39. And I said that all of the experiences that he encounters in little boxes, those real life experiences explain why Black people like Nelson Ellis die at 39. Your thoughts?
I'll say that, you know, I did, upon rewatching, I knew that he had passed. And it did make me see that there are just scenes where he just looks tired. I thought, you know, it's a great performance, but you look at him, you think, you know, is this a guy that is really beaten down? And is he really weary to his bones in that way that is coming through in that performance? I think that, you know, the filmmakers say that they wanted to have a kind of a response to Black Lives Matter and sort of in solidarity with that, they said, in telling a story that wouldn't be the typical story of tragedy of, like, you know, someone shot in gang violence and that kind of, or someone shot, you know, gang violence meaning with the police. But rather than playing it for that kind of tragedy, have it play out on the level of the family. It's interesting the way that you've just given that context. It is still a tragedy that you can see before your eyes. It's a very real tragedy. I think he gives a very moving performance.
I would concur. And I would contrast that. Particularly just your thoughts on Melanie Lynskey's character, her role as a mother. I think there are a lot of scenes. We just played one where Mark Burns is kind of counseling, consoling his son or talking to his son. They have an earlier scene where the white mom, she gets upset about the 2-bit poster in his room because she's got on like some skimpy clothing or what have you. And she goes outside and she tells him about it. And she says, handle it. And she storms away and leaves him to go and talk to his son and deal with this disciplinary problem. Most of the time, she's not the one that goes to meet Ambrosia when they're first getting acclimated in the neighborhood. Mark Burns takes the son over to meet her and meet the parents and stay with them. He's doing more of the parenting stuff. What's our evaluation of her as a mother?
Yeah, she's got limitations. I mean, she wants to delegate the labor. I mean, as you said, she issues a command and she says, "Just fix it." In that scene, you know, with the 2-bit poster, and you know, it's nice the way it plays out in the sense that she scripted a certain thing for him to say, but he doesn't stick to her script. He's going to do some sort of loving parenting of this child and sort of be there for him, and not give him some big lecture at that particular moment. But I'll also say everything that sets her off about this poster, she fixates on one dimension of it and one dimension of it only. She very specifically says, "This isn't how I want you to see women." And she also then says, you know, this is sexist. But, you know, she never once is, you know, expresses concern that this is a negative image, say, of a non-white woman, a negative image of a Black woman, that there's not in those moments, even when she's being sort of triggered by those posters, she's not concerned with that aspect of the identity. So it's another, I mean, Emily, she ends up, she's, you know, that's her deal academically. Like, she's teaching a course on, you know, the female gaze, and she's trying to do feminist work with her photography. And I mean, that's a work that can be done, but she has been a way of, in her parenting, sort of her directives to her son seem to be limited to that sphere. And she's going to leave kind of the racial education to the man in this case.
Yeah, I thought of her character as being pretty, talking about self-serving. I think we mentioned that with Ray Liotta's character in The Place Beyond the Pines. I thought of that a lot with her character as well. And something that a point I've brought up frequently with tragic arrangements, what they call interracial relationships, patterns that I've seen with the white parent, and do they teach their offspring, non-white offspring, about racism, white supremacy? That's something that we've talked about consistently on this program. But also just like when she goes to get Walter. Walter is like Clark's cousin. She goes to get him. I think he lives actually in Seattle, in Washington. It's like a 3-hour drive from this fictitious Rome. So she goes to get him to bring him in for for Mark Burns' birthday, and then he can also hang out with Clark, say, around the same age. She goes to do this, but at the time that she goes to do it, there's lots of discord in the house. The move has not gone well. Clark is frustrated with her. Then she goes to bring in Walter, and I felt like it was not I'm doing this for the family. I felt like this was I'm doing this for me. I can get some brownie points because I made this 3-hour drive to go get Walter and bring him back. She does not make that sacrifice to make sure that he gets back safely. She just puts him on the bus. 16-year-old black male, you can get that 3-hour bus ride back across Washington State. But and even her going to get the book, she goes and yells at the white guy at the bookstore, I need to get this book. I need to get this book for Clark. And he doesn't have it. So she yells at him. And then she goes to Seattle. When she gets Walter, she gets the book. But again, it just feels very self-serving. It does not seem like she does not invest genuine empathy, energy, in my opinion, in her fan. And I think she gets called out on that too. Even like with the mold, something as serious as that. I think he tells her about this way early in the film and she just kind of blows it off. She's drinking, she's doing her professor thing and what have you. And then she comes back and says, oh my God, what is this all over the house? It's mold. I've been telling you, you're not even paying attention to the problems that, you know, we are encountering in this move that was all for you and your best interest. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I specifically keyed in on that moment with the mold. I think she says something like, what did you do? And to me, that's like a thing you say to your child. Like, you know, look what you did. Like somehow the fact that there's mold in the house that she bought is now his fault. And now she's going to be talking down to him in that way that you would lecture a child that has, you know, misbehaved or just broken a toy. You know, look what you did or what did you do? Yeah, she's very quick to be accusatory and defensive. Go ahead.
Oh, my fault. Please. Go ahead.
No, I think that there are parts of this where I think the scriptwriter wants to portray her as flawed and full human, but I think it's there's a consistent pattern here that is as you say, a revealing of her consistent selfishness.
Even absconding at the end, the recklessness all the way, reminding me somewhat again of I don't feel at home in this world anymore. The kind of impulsive acts at the end, and the black kind of have to calm her down. And at that point, Clark confesses, yes, I broke the window, and everything is resolved from there. Everything rebounds, and the film basically wraps up. I think I got most of the main points that I wanted to get to on the film. It's always difficult because with some of these, you could, you know, just talk and talk and talk for days. But folks have seen the films. I think some of the points that we have been going over for the past few hours, I think, will stand out. If you've not seen any of these films, if you make time to check them out, you should have lots to mull over. If you go through any of these projects, I think the films that I would probably say check out at the top of the list, Big Lebowski, because I suspect that's one that a lot of people have seen and maybe not thought about some of the things that were discussed today, and Little Boxes, just because that I thought it was. I enjoy films that have a lot of racist humor, and I felt that film had a lot of racist humor, some of it intended, some of it maybe not, but I enjoyed, and it's something you can analyze in one of Nelson Ellis's final performances as an actor. Any final comments you wanted to make sure that you get in before we wrap things up, Dr. Kevorkian? You've been generous with your time again.
Well, I've been overly long-winded is what I've been, but thank you. I did have a kind of a comment, and maybe it's a question, but it's about something that the kid says early on, what you said about the cousin jogged my memory about this, that you know, the mom says, you know, that the cousin might visit, and the kid says, he called me a blurred. Did you catch that line, or did that?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
He called me a blurred, and that was like a new word for me, and I tried to look it up, and I guess it refers to black nerd. So combining the words black and nerd, but maybe it's just because I was looking on the internet. It seemed to me, and I took this to be encouraging, that that's not necessarily an insult. In other words, the kid saying he called me a blurred, like that was some outrage, or like he would be insulted to be called that. But it seems to me that there are people on their internets that are sort of proudly claiming this identity of being blurred, like sort of reveling in that, in the same way that, you know, someone would say now, you know, oh, I'm a film geek, or I'm, you know, it's like really being into something, like that it can be a positive thing, that it's sort of contrary to the, in other words, the expectation in this movie that I mentioned before, that these young girls place on this young non-white man, is that they don't want him to wear his glasses. And I think that's sort of saying to him, don't be a blurred. Don't be the person who appears to be studious or scholarly or takes learning seriously. So I thought it was interesting that he's identified as a blurred, and it also says his cousin is also an honor student. So those are, in a sense, positive portrayals. But I just based on the limited digging I did, it seemed like the film wasn't using that term correctly, that like he was taking it as an insult, but there are positive aspects of black culture that are saying that that's not an insult, that it's a badge of pride to be called that. So I can stand to be corrected on any of these things, but it's something that sparked my curiosity and made me think about that idea of being black versus being white, and that it's okay to be identified as scholarly.
I have limited experience hearing the term blurred. I'd heard it before this film, but I also have heard it used positively, like not as an insult, but as something uplifting. Like, we're proud to be thought of as blurreds. I've seen, you know, people blogging using that title, or, you know, they just casually reference themselves or others in that way. I have seen that, and I did not get that impression from the film. You're right. I got it as something negative, as though being called that was a bad thing, being a black person or being a non-white person, and being, as you said, scholarly, studious. Even in the film, they don't like his choice of music. Like, they kind of frown when he gives titles that I guess would not commonly be associated with, like, pop culture, 50 Cent type tunes. And then he's into reading whatever this, it's something similar to like a Harry Potter type, really popular children's book. And he's into this series. He's reading it, and they're going to go to the bookstore. They're doing a book signing, and the book has just been released. He's going to get a new book, and Ambrosia kind of leading the way and saying, this is, you know, whack. We don't want to be reading. We want to go to the diner so I can tell some racist jokes, and that's what they do. But that would be another example. You don't want to read. Reading is for losers. Let's, you know, go listen to our 2-bit. But yeah, that seemed to be a running theme in the film as well, in a variety of different ways. The glasses, the book, the music. Lots of different ways. With that, folks, if you have any thoughts, if you get to see any of these projects down the road, right, you listen to the archive and then you go check them out. If you want to drop an email, feel free, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have any thoughts or anything sticks out, you can let us know. Much obliged for spending some time with us once again, Dr. Kevorkian. Always grand to hear from you. Any of the books left over last time you were with us, you had surplus books. I know people took advantage and emailed in to get a copy. Is that still a possibility, or did we miss out on all the copies?
No, that is still a possibility. And I responded to a good first wave. I really appreciate the people who took an interest and asked for those. I have to apologize. There are some people out there that I know I owe some books to. So I haven't forgotten you, and I'll dig up some more copies. So let me know if that's something that you're interested in. Please do. Thank you.
Will
M. Kevorkian at utexas.edu.
M. Kevorkian at utexas.edu. Is that correct?
that's where you can reach me, and hopefully I'll be paying attention, and then I'll catch up with my emails to the people I already owe these to. So
spectacular. And you can feel free to drop me an email as well. I know some people did write me last. Many people did, actually. I had to redirect them to your email, but you can drop me an email if you get confused, or if you want to see if you can still get a copy of Color Monitors, The Black Face of Technology in America, and I will forward along. If you missed out the first time around or are interested this year, first time hearing about the offer to get a free copy of Dr. Kevorkian's published work. With that, we will be here again on Thursday for Workplace Racism and Friday for France Fund. We haven't done our book study session in weeks. We've had back-to-back weeks of wisdom teeth being removed, but there are no more wisdom teeth to remove, and I'm doing better, so we should be back for the book club this coming Friday. Thanks for all the folks who tuned in, folks who stayed up late on the East Coast. Right on. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. And Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing again, got to read some of her work, but I am sure she would want me to say it again. Reading is more important than watching television. Absolutely. Get a copy of the ISIS Papers and check that out, and then go watch The Big Lebowski, or get Vincent Woodard's The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture, and then go check out The Big Lebowski. I'm sure you will be thinking or have some different thoughts pop into mind. With that, thanks for everyone tuning in. Thank you for Dr. Kevorkian spending time with us. Context of white supremacy, we will conclude. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.